You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Because our assets far exceed our debt, we will be forced in bankruptcy to pay our debt in full, 100 cents on the dollar. You know, when companies or individuals have a lot of debt and a small amount of assets, the creditors have to take like 10 cents on the dollar or 20 cents on the dollar, whatever is agreed in bankruptcy. But that's not the case when your assets exceed your debt. When your assets exceed your debt, you have to pay all of your debt. So there's no benefit. Bankruptcy will not decrease our debt. In fact, the expense of bankruptcy itself is very high.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Grace Aaron. Today's show, What Way Forward for Pacifica? Grace Aaron currently serves on the Los Angeles KPFK Local Station Board and the Pacifica Foundation National Board. She served on the Los Angeles KPFK Local Station Board from 2003 to 2009 and on the Pacifica National Board in 2008 and 2009. She was the chair of the Pacifica National Board in 2009 and the interim executive director of the Pacifica Foundation in that year. She is a longtime peace and anti-nuclear activist and currently is on the board of the Los Angeles branch of Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. She has been an active organizer for peace action for many years. Today we discuss the financial crisis at the Pacifica Radio Network, options going forward, and possible long-term solutions. Grace Aaron, welcome.
Well, I'm glad to be on your show, Bonnie.
The Pacifica Foundation owns the licenses for five radio stations, KDFK in Los Angeles, WPFW in Washington, D.C., KPFT in Houston, WBAI in New York City, and KPFA in Berkeley. The Empire State Building in New York City hosts the transmitter for WBAI, Pacifica's New York station. Why did the Empire State Realty Trust sue Pacifica, and how did the loss of this lawsuit lead to the present financial crisis at Pacifica?
What happened was, is it okay if I give a little history about this?
Absolutely. That's what I'd like you to do.
Let me explain. When the Twin Towers were destroyed in 2001, WBAI was being transmitted atop the Empire State Building. That's where our transmitter was. However, the rest of the towers for radio, or a lot of the towers for radio and TV broadcasting, were on the top of the Twin Towers, which was the highest point in New York City. The reason for that is the buildings block a lot of the radio signals, so in order to have good reception, you have to be at the highest point amidst the skyscrapers. So we had a lease atop the Empire State Building, which became very valuable because now it was the only game in town. Our lease expired in 2005. At that time, Ambrose Lane, who was for a very brief period the interim executive director and I believe the chair of the National Board of Pacifica, signed a 15-year contract with the Empire State Building, which the Empire State Building at that time basically had a monopoly on tower space. So we signed this lease. He signed it for the Pacifica Foundation. It was, approved by the Pacifica National Board. That had nothing to do with the management of WBAI itself. The board of Pacifica signed that 15-year contract. I think the 15-year contract started off at a reasonable monthly rate for a license and rent on the Empire State Building for the transmitter. And then, but there were escalator clauses and penalties and all kinds of things. So right now, the rent is up to, I think, about $60,000 a month, which is incredibly a huge burden on WBAI. Now, Since the there are other sites now in New York because the World Trade Center has been built and there are towers on top of the World Trade Center and there's another place called Four Times Square. But anyway, now the rates are lower for renting space for your tower transmitter in New York City. So the normal rate now, if we didn't have this contract, would be between $12,000 a month and $17,000 a month in rent. So we are still bound by the contract we have with them for another 3 years until, I believe it's June of 2020, at a high rate, about $60,000 a month, and I think it's increasing. What happened was WBAI was no longer able to pay the rent, so there was a handshake agreement with the original owner of the Empire State Building between Berthold Reimers and the head at that time. And the agreement was to pay $12,000 a month, but it was just a verbal agreement that that would be accepted. So for a while, that was accepted. What happened was, and nobody actually worked out, got that written down and agreed to legally on paper. And, you know, that really wasn't the fault of WBAI because that kind of agreement cannot be made locally by the WBAI general manager or anyone locally at that station because Pacifica owns WBAI. And so it would have to have been done by a senior management person and the national board of Pacifica to iron that out, and that was not done. So it was a failure of the national management and national board of Pacifica, not particularly of WBAI itself. So anyway, what happened was a number of years ago, the Empire State Building was sold, and it was bought by a very large real estate investment trust called the Empire State Realty Trust. They owe a huge amount of real estate in the New York area. Tens of billions of dollars worth of real estate. It's a huge, huge publicly traded corporation. So we have this contract, and we became behind on those monthly payments. So we were so far behind that the Empire State Realty Trust got a summary judgment against us. We didn't sue them. They sued us for payment, because they know that we have a lot of assets and we could eventually pay them if we had to. So they got this judgment a number of months ago, and we have been trying to figure out how to pay them. We also are accumulating more debt to them because every month we still have the rent of about $60,000 a month, and we have not been paying it in full every month as we should be, or as we're obligated to in that contract. Does that answer the question?
I just wanted to clarify a couple of things. So the Empire State Realty Trust sued Pacifica for the original contract amount, which was an escalating amount, and at this point it was $60,000. Now, on the verbal handshake agreement with WBAI to accept $12,000 per month, was that agreement that verbal agreement for $12,000 a month, is that all they were going to accept, or were they simply deferring the rest of it?
You know, it's not clear what that agreement was. It was assumed to be that, well, we'll iron it out and we'll work out a payment plan for the remainder, or we'll rewrite the contract. It's not clear what that verbal handshake agreement was.
I see.
But it's true that Empire State at that time was accepting $12,000 a month. They weren't trying to sue us at that time. But after that, we got more and more behind. So it accumulated. And when Empire State Realty Trust started trying to get the judgment, it was at $1.8 million. Now it's more than that because at the time they got the judgment, it was, I don't know, 6 or 8 months ago, and now we're still further behind in our payment.
Right. So how much was the summary judgment against Pacifica, and how much in total does Pacifica owe the Empire State Realty Trust? I also understand that the debt to ESRT also includes interest and penalties. Is that right?
Yes. So we owe them, the summary judgment is for $1.839 and change, $1,839,000 and change, plus attorney's fees. We're not sure how much the attorney's fees are going to wind up being. We haven't gotten that information yet.
And Pacific is also accruing interest and penalties on this amount of money, right?
Yes, and Empire State is charging us 9% on the arrears. So we're paying interest on that money that we owe them, plus penalties. And we are in arrears another, I would say, between $400,000 and $500,000 since that summary judgment. However, if we pay the summary judgment, if we pay it in full, Empire State will not be able to attach our assets, which is the dilemma we're facing now.
I see. So what is Pacifica's total debt to all creditors? Could you break this down for us?
I don't have an exact number. The CFO, Chief Financial Officer of Pacifica, pegs it at about $8 million currently. I think it might be a little less than that, but let's leave the figure at $8 million, and I'm only going to give you rough figures, not exact figures. I'd say we owe the Empire State Realty Trust, as of today, probably about $2.5 million. That's the summary judgment, plus the legal fees, plus whatever we've accrued in unpaid rent since the summary judgment. So I'd say it's about $2.5 million. I believe we owe Amy Goodman about $2.5 million, but she's not pressing us for that money. Then we owe $750,000 or so in back pension plan payments. And then we owe other sundry debts to old lawyers we never paid, and their real estate taxes that we owe on the KPFA building and on the building next to it that we own that houses the national office. And so there are a bunch of other bills that we've never paid that are part of our total debt.
I see. So in a ballpark figure, you're saying about $8
million. Yes. Might be a little less than that.
Oh, okay. So that's...
I don't have the exact figure.
That's probably tops. Okay. Well, so then what are Pacifica's total assets?
The total assets, the real estate was appraised this year, and all of the real estate totals about between $10 and $11 million in value. That's the buildings that house the KPFA building, the KPFK building, the KPFT building in Houston, and that extra building that houses the national office that's right next to the KPFA building. So that's a total of four buildings, and as I said, they're worth between $10 and $11 million in total.
So that's the real estate assets, and I just wanted to point out that there are two storefronts next to the KPFA radio station, but actually those two storefronts, that constitutes one building. Isn't that right?
Yes. I haven't been there in a long time, so I believe it may have two entrances. It may kind of be two buildings. It has two street addresses, but I think it's 1921 Martin Luther King Way and 1925, but it's considered one building.
Okay, so in real estate assets, you're saying maybe the Pacifica owns a ballpark $10 to $11 million. Now, what are the other assets? For instance, the signals.
The signals are extremely valuable. In fact, somebody a week or so ago sent me a very interesting piece of information from Variety magazine. It was in an article from May 9th, 2017. I'll just read this little blurb. Emma's Communication has sold popular Los Angeles hip-hop radio station KPWR Power 106 to the Meruelo Group for $82.75 million pending FCC and other regulatory approvals. That's an amazing amount of money for a Los Angeles radio station, $82.75 million. That's a recent sale of a signal. So we have very, very valuable signals. They're not all of the same value. The WBAI signal is maybe the most valuable one because it's in the number one media mecca of the United States, the largest population area. And, of course, New York City is very influential. I believe the WBAI signal, if it were sold outright, would be worth about $48 million. That's what we've been told. I'm not sure the value of the KPFK signal, which is very valuable, the KPFA signal, or the KPFT signal, or the Washington, D.C. signal, which I believe Washington, D.C., that signal is worth about $14 million if sold outright.
I'm speaking with Pacifica National Director Grace Aaron. Today's show, What Way Forward for Pacifica? I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. So in addition to the signals, which are worth a lot, multiple million dollars, and the real estate, what are Pacifica's other assets? I mean, obviously, there's the Pacifica Audio Port with all the programming. I mean, what other assets does Pacifica have?
I think that's about it in terms of tangible assets. Well, the tangible assets would be the real estate. I don't think that the archives, which are extremely important, but I don't think that they are very sellable. In other words, I don't think we could auction the archives and raise money, a significant amount of money from the archives. I don't know for sure, but most of the archives need to be digitized. So in the state that they're in, old tape recordings, basically, that are not digitized for the most part, in that state, they probably are not sellable. So the main assets are the signals themselves and the real estate. There may be a few other things. I mean, there are probably towers and transmitters and things like that. I really don't have an idea of what their value would be, but I don't think it would be as significant as either the signals or the real estate.
So then is it safe to say that Pacifica's assets far outweigh its debts?
Absolutely. That's the danger. At the moment, we have a $2 million debt, and we have probably $150 million in assets. So we simply have to pay that debt. And if we can't pay it out of our operating revenue, we're going to have to pay it by selling an asset. And that's the conundrum, because the stations don't want to have their assets sold. In New York, people who love WBAI don't want to have their radio station either degraded by a swap. There's a thing called a signal swap. So sometimes you can sell a signal for a partly cash payment and also another signal of lesser value. So there's talk about a signal swap so that we could generate enough money to pay our debt and still have a radio station, but it wouldn't be as good a signal as the one we have now in New York.
Well, in your research, what have you discovered about the option of a signal swap for the New York station? What is this option, and what would it solve, and how viable is it?
Well, the problem with a signal swap is we have our bylaws, and our bylaws state that in order to sell or swap a signal, there must be a membership vote that approves that. And we have about 55,000 members, so a mailing would have to be sent out to the membership asking if they would approve a signal swap or sale. But before that even, you know, the National Board would have to agree on a very specific signal swap, because we're not talking about a generalized notion of a signal swap. There has to be an offer. It has to be investigated. The board would have to agree that it's a good idea and vote to sell or swap a signal. And so after the board decides, and after there's due diligence on the part of the seller and buyer, which takes time, then there would have to be a vote of the membership, and then it goes for FCC approval. The FCC approval process is a time-consuming process. It's 90 days at the very least, and there's a 30-day public comment period. And in that public comment period, if there are objections, that could very much lengthen the time for the FCC approval process. So a signal swap or sale, if there's significant objection, could take 2 years, 3 years, who knows? There's no way to tell how lengthy that process would be. It certainly would never be a short process. There's a concept that possibly in bankruptcy it would be made easier. But bankruptcy will not affect the FCC part of the process. So even if some say that in bankruptcy we don't have to have a membership vote, I don't know if that's true. That's a supposition that some people have who favor bankruptcy. I do not favor bankruptcy. But that's an idea that's been floated that we could get around having to do a membership vote. But in bankruptcy, there's no way to get out of the FCC process. And that can be very lengthy.
What did you find out when you looked into the FM signals presently in New York City?
Well, I found out that I looked up all the FM signals in the New York metropolitan area, and I believe there are only 17 or so. That's not very many signals. It's not like you sell a house in a market where there are hundreds and hundreds of houses for sale, and so you can sell or buy a house fairly easily. There's not a lot of inventory when it comes to signals. So the choice of a signal sale or swap, you might want to sell a radio signal. There might not be any buyers. Or I think that selling a radio signal might be easier than trying to swap it because there aren't that many signals available in any one geographical area that are eligible to be swapped. So it's a kind of a tricky process. There's no guarantee that a good offer will come around or that there will be any offers at all.
Exactly.
So the devil is in the details with a lot of these things.
Yeah, it sounds to me like this is no simple solution at all.
It's not simple. It's very complicated. And people like to make it, oh, we'll just sell the WBAI signal and all our problems will be solved because, look, it's so valuable. I don't think this foundation, in my opinion, does not need money. It needs income. We need to improve the programming at our radio stations so that we have more listeners and so that we have more impact on the world around us. I am a peace activist. I've been a longtime peace activist. And Pacifica, we need to really explain why more peaceful resolution of conflict on a global level and a better stewardship of the environment and better human rights and better civil liberties is the way to go as species. And this is what Pacifica to me is all about. And it's very important. And having the stations just have an infusion of money to hobble along in the condition that they're currently in, I don't think is the way to go. We need to get more income, and the way that that will happen is by having really engaging, important, vital programming that explains a lot of things and that the population in these signal areas want to hear and find important and enlightening and inspiring. That's what Pacific is all about. It's not about just having a big bank account that you can run through. To me, it's important to keep this vital resource alive and vital. Can I segue a little bit and mention something which I forgot to mention in the beginning?
Yes.
In an open session of the Pacifica National Board, a public session, on January 4th, a resolution was adopted. It states, all managers, employees, and board members of Pacifica must state clearly that any comments they make to media, including Pacifica programs, about the current Pacifica situation regarding the Empire State Realty Trust summary judgment are not made in their official capacity, but only as their personal opinion. Official statements can only be made after they are approved by the Pacifica National Board. So I'm not speaking as a national board member, although I am a national board member, and I'm not speaking for the board or for the management of Pacifica. I'm giving you my personal opinion. I think that that's kind of understood, but I wanted to make it clear.
Now, after the summary judgment with the ESRT, and this is, we're talking on January 16th, where does the situation rest presently? Technically, are Pacifica assets presently at risk?
Yes, absolutely. The Empire State Realty Trust has moved forward and is now capable of attaching our assets at all of our signal areas. So they can put liens on all of our properties if they haven't already, and they can take money directly out of our bank accounts at this point.
So what I am hearing is that there are two ways to deal with the current financial crisis at Pacifica. Either take out loans to pay the judgment against Pacifica to ESRT, or declare bankruptcy. Let's start with the loan option. What did the Pacifica National Board vote to do about this summary judgment?
The Pacifica National Board, I'll just read you the report out from the closed session, the executive session of the Pacifica National Board on January 2nd. The board approved the terms for two loans. The smaller one will be offered to Empire State Realty Trust to show good faith and will only be funded if Empire State Realty Trust agrees to give us more time before seizing any of our assets. And the larger one will be used to pay off the smaller bridge loan as well as the balance owed to Empire State Realty Trust if they agree to forbear. The proceeds from this loan would also be used to pay some other Pacifica debt. Loan repayment planning shall be a priority. Now, there was a little change in what's happening since this motion passed, since this happened, and that is that we don't believe Empire State will give us any more time. They want the payment in full. So the loan that we're looking at would be for full payment of the entire summary judgment, which would make it impossible, if it's paid, for Empire State to seize any of our assets. They would have to go back to the court and get another summary judgment. So because they're charging us 9% interest on the money we owe them, it seems logical to me that we would take out a loan at the same interest rate or even a little higher, a little lower, to pay off Empire State. At least our assets wouldn't be seized. Now, the loan expense is the same whether we take a loan or we do nothing, because it's basically a loan. We owe money to Empire State, and they can charge us interest on that money, 9%, which is a pretty high rate of interest.
Well, what can you reveal publicly about the two loans that are presently in the works? And could you also explain how taking out loans to pay off the judgment against Pacifica is not creating additional debt?
Yeah, we owe money. So some of the money we owe is accruing interest for the people we owe it to. We're going to have to pay interest on the money. That's particularly true of the Empire State Realty Trust, the debt we have to them. I can't give you details about the loans. I believe there's been public information in emails, and I think that there's a friendly loan. People here down at KPFK got together and decided to loan Pacifica money. These are people who are not super wealthy. They do have money in retirement accounts, and they're willing to take the risk of loaning it to Pacifica at an interest rate, so they would get some return for their investment. The loans would be using Pacifica real estate as collateral, in this case, the KPFK building. And they're in process. There's another loan that would probably have better terms, but that won't be available to us for a couple of months, more or less. So we need something more quickly because we're at great risk of Empire State The greatest risk we have right now is that Empire State taps into our bank accounts, making the stations not able to operate. They can easily put liens on our buildings, but it would take them quite a while to foreclose on our real estate and force us to sell the real estate. But the bank accounts could be basically just tapped into and money extracted from them, which would make it impossible for the radio stations to pay their bills, pay their staff. So that is a serious situation that's facing us.
I'm speaking with Pacifica National Director Grace Aaron. Today's show, What Way Forward for Pacifica? I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. So the Empire State Realty Trust has had this ability to tap into Pacifica's bank account since when? Since January 8th, and it's now it's the 16th?
Yes.
And they haven't done anything so far?
No, they haven't. I think they are aware that we're seriously considering. This is just speculation on my part, but I believe that they know that we're really trying to find a loan and pay them. I don't think they're willing to put anything in writing saying that they won't seize our assets or that they'll give us more time, but that seems to be what's happening. But there's no guarantee of that. I don't know. They could at any moment start taking money from our bank accounts.
Now, with regard to the two loans, there's a smaller one and a larger one. And then the larger loan would be available like within a few months from now, and that would pay off the earlier smaller one. Is that right?
Yes.
And how would the loans be secured?
So at this point, we have to face the fact that in the short term, we're going to have to sell assets or mortgage assets to pay the Empire State Realty Trust. And actually, to pay the payments going forward for the length of the rest of that contract.
So now you're saying that these loans that are in the works, they would be secured by, I believe you said, Pacifica Real Estate, specifically the KPFK building. Is that correct?
Well, yes. The first loan, I believe, would be secured by the KPFK building. The second loan by more than one piece of property.
Have any of the Pacifica properties been put up for sale yet?
Yes. The property in Berkeley that houses some of the national office staff has been put on the market recently.
So that's the loan option, I guess, that the National Board has voted for. What about the bankruptcy option? What are the pluses and minuses of declaring the network bankrupt? Let's start with the positives. What are those?
Well, the positives of bankruptcy would be that we would have much more time, or some more time, to pay off our debt while still maintaining our operations. So that's the main plus. It would not decrease our debt at all. Or if it did decrease the debt, it would be a very small amount. Because our assets far exceed our debt, we will be forced in bankruptcy to pay our debt in full, 100 cents on the dollar. You know, when companies or individuals have a lot of debt and a small amount of assets, the creditors have to take like 10 cents on the dollar or 20 cents on the dollar, whatever is agreed in bankruptcy. But that's not the case when your assets exceed your debt. When your assets exceed your debt, you have to pay all of your debt. So there's no benefit. Bankruptcy will not decrease our debt. In fact, the expense of bankruptcy itself is very high. One lawyer estimated that the cost of bankruptcy for Pacifica would be between $500,000 and $1 million, and the other one said $750,000 to $1 million at least. And these two lawyers, I don't think, have an understanding of how complicated Pacifica is as a nonprofit. And politically, there are so many different dynamics going on with Pacifica that I'm sure that will negatively impact the bankruptcy process and have it cost more than that $1 million figure. And that $1 million figure adds to our debt. It doesn't do anything. So we might have time to stretch out payment of the debt, but we'll still have to pay all of it. And that's the other downside of bankruptcy. We will be pressured, we will be forced in bankruptcy to pay all of our debt, all $8 million or so. If we're not in bankruptcy, we don't have to pay all of that debt. Some of that debt could go on for a very long time without the creditor pushing us. And that's mainly Amy Goodman. I don't think that she would force us into bankruptcy to pay her the $2.5 million that we owe her. But in bankruptcy, we would be forced to by the court. So that's a big downside of bankruptcy. So the upside is just that it would take the pressure off for a short period of time, and we would have time to figure out how to pay the debt. But we can figure that out without going into bankruptcy, which is extremely expensive. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to make the best decision. There are no good options. There's no secret magic bullet or cure or pill that we have right now. We have to sell or mortgage assets in order to pay debt in part or in full, and then figure out how to improve our income so that we're able to carry the debt moving forward.
So there are costs associated with bankruptcy. Now, what all does bankruptcy entail? This is a very complex process. What is a committee of creditors?
Well, a committee of creditors is the significant creditors, the people that we owe money to. They form a committee. And the foundation has 120 days, maybe it's 180 days, to come up with a plan to figure out how to continue the operations of the network and also how to pay off the creditors, a payment plan, essentially, for the creditors. Now, if the committee of creditors rejects the plan or the judge rejects the plan, then the committee of creditors can kind of force us into a course of action that we might not like. Now, I personally think it's very doubtful that the committee of creditors will put up with a signal sale or swap option that could take literally years to complete. They will probably force the sale of real estate. And if we have to pay all of our debt, see, this is the trick here. If we have to pay all of our debt and the court, that's the option that's forced on us by the creditors because they want their money more quickly, then we would lose virtually all of our real estate, because it will take all of our real estate to pay $8 million in debt, plus the cost of bankruptcy itself. So that brings it up to $9 million or so, at least. And the assets, the real estate assets we own, are worth between $10 and $11 million. So you do the math and you find out that probably every building that Pacifica owns, including the KPFA studio, will have to be sold in bankruptcy. I mean, maybe there's a way to get around that, but I don't know of one. We've consulted with bankruptcy attorneys, and I don't see a way out from that. The only way would be if the creditors are willing to wait for a signal sale or swap. And in the case of a signal sale or swap, who knows what the if there's a trustee, if the board becomes very dysfunctional, or it's decided that there's some gross malfeasance, which there really isn't in Pacifica and the Pacifica board operations currently, a trustee could be appointed. Who's to say that the trustee would decide that the signal to be sold would be the WBAI signal? Maybe that's not a good business decision. Maybe there would be a better signal swap offer for KPFA. Or KPFK, or KPFT, or WPFW. So if it's a strict business decision, if it makes more business sense to swap out or sell the KPFA signal to pay off the debt, that could happen in bankruptcy because we lose control. So I think it's better if the Pacifica community comes together, takes out a loan. I'm not saying that the signal swap or sale option is off the table. We need the time to work it out. We need the time to figure out which direction we want to go in. Do we want to mortgage real estate? Do we want to sell real estate? Do we want to take out some loans to give us some time to figure out what other assets to sell or how to fix the network? I think that the East Coast station can be improved so that we're not that far away from viability. It's just that we need an increase in income, basically, which means we need to run these stations better. And don't forget, in June, I believe, of 2020, our contract with the Empire State Realty Trust will be over, and we will be able to rent tower space at a much reduced monthly amount. So this is not a forever thing. This expense will not last forever.
I'm speaking with Pacifica National Director Grace Aaron. Today's show, What Lay Forward for Pacifica. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
The other thing is, in bankruptcy, our finance staff, our efforts will be geared to what the creditors want to know in terms of financial information about the network. Now, we are behind in our financial reporting to federal and state institutions. We still haven't completed our 2016 audit. We should be doing our 2017 audit. And instead of that, it seems that efforts by our national finance staff have been going into bankruptcy preparation, which is putting our nonprofit status at risk, because the deadline, the extended deadline for the completion of the 2016 audit, fiscal audit, is February 14th, 2016, and that audit has barely been started. It's a very complicated process, and I'm fearful if we can't get another extension that, you know, our nonprofit status is in jeopardy. So if we go into bankruptcy, how are we going to fix that? We're going to have to find money somewhere to hire extra staff. Now, how will we get that money? Well, we'll either have to sell an asset very quickly to pay for the cost of bankruptcy, or we're going to have to take out loans. Now, in bankruptcy, the interest rates are very high, much higher than interest rates we could get from taking a loan out outside of bankruptcy, before bankruptcy, or to prevent bankruptcy. So that's another concern. It is possible to get loans if you're in bankruptcy. But we had a friend did some research about this, and this is from a company called Quick Liquidity in Baton Rouge, Florida. And they said, per our conversation, as an estimate for a debtor-in-possession loan, that's what these kinds of loans are called, on a property in Los Angeles as a first mortgage, I believe the all-in cost will be 12 to 16%. That's a very high interest rate. Another debtor-in-possession lender, there aren't that many of them. These are lenders that lend to companies in bankruptcy. Another one in Sacramento, California, called Blackburn & Sons Realty Capital Corporation, says, again, the rates on something like this would be in the range of 12.9% to 13.9% or so. Our loan would have to be in the first position on the property. So these are all loans that are collateralized by buildings. In other words, if we don't pay, we lose the building. It gives the right of the lender to foreclose on the property that's being used as collateral. So in bankruptcy, we don't have the cash to pay for the very expensive accountants that the creditors are going to demand that we hire to get our books in order. And we will have to either rapidly sell an asset, and the only asset that we can sell rapidly would be real estate, or we will have to take out loans in bankruptcy based on real estate that we own, and those loans will have an extremely high interest rate if we have to take out more than one loan. So I don't think that that's a good option. Plus, diverting away from getting our financial reporting in order is causing us to have a very poor credit rating, and we're in jeopardy of losing our Corporation for Public Broadcast funding once again. And that's one of the reasons we're in the situation we're in, because past senior management and past boards of Pacifica have failed to ensure that our financial reporting is done in a timely manner. So because of that, we've lost over $3.5 million of Corporation for Public Broadcast funding. If it weren't for that, if we had had that funding, we wouldn't be in the situation. We would have been able to pay the Empire State Building, even if we didn't want to. Well, we don't have a choice. We have the contract. But we would have been able to afford it because we'd have that Corporation for Public Broadcast funding, and we wouldn't have gotten this far in arrears.
Pacifica lost the Corporation for Public Broadcasting funding because they didn't have the audits done in time. Is that correct?
Correct.
And not having the audits done in time has also jeopardized the Pacifica nonprofit status. Is that right?
Yes, yes. There's a lot of talk blaming WBAI for the financial situation we're in. But WBAI is one of five stations. It's the responsibility of the national board and all of the stations and national management to get financial reporting done, because we are one foundation. The Pacifica Foundation owns all of the stations and all of the properties. So the KPFK building is not owned by KPFK. It's owned by Pacifica. The KPFA building is not owned by KPFA. It's owned by Pacifica. Pacifica Foundation owns all the signals and all the real estate. And no one station lost us RCPB funding. The National Board is composed of representatives from all five stations, plus two affiliate representatives. So if the National Board did not ensure the timely preparation of audits of our books and lost because of that, because of that negligence or oversight, lost $3.5 million of Corporation for Public Broadcast funding, then, you know, there's enough blame to go around. We shouldn't be targeting one station. It's the responsibility of all of Pacifica to make sure that our financial house is in order.
Well, are there any other big unknowns about declaring bankruptcy? This is a very unpredictable process, isn't it?
Very unpredictable. There are all kinds of theories. There are a lot of bankruptcy statutes. So a lot can happen. Who knows? It's kind of Russian roulette, because these are federally appointed judges. It's federal. The bankruptcy courts are federal. The other very dangerous thing is we're granted our radio signals by the Federal Communication Commission. I don't think it's often that the FCC pulls a license. But this is the Trump administration. Who knows what could happen? Do we really want to let the FCC know, or have the FCC have the impression that we are not good stewards of these licenses? They are very, very, very valuable. It's our obligation to make sure that they're managed well, that these are public airwaves. If we seem to be too dysfunctional, there's a possibility that the FCC could take our licenses and give them to somebody they think, or some nonprofit they think would be a better steward of one or more licenses. So I think it's very dangerous to not deal with this process in a rational way. I mean, we have huge amounts of assets. To me, a $2 million loan to pay off a debt, or a $2 million debt, is minuscule when you look at our $150 million in assets, $10 million or $11 million in real estate alone. I mean, it's silly to say that taking a $2 million loan on $11 million in property is crazy. It's not crazy. If it were crazy, everybody in the country who owns a home and has a mortgage would be considered to be crazy. We were very lucky to have been given this real estate by donors in the past. Very lucky. It's a wonderful legacy. that we have, and we should be taking good care of it. I am not in favor of selling any real estate if we can hold on to it, although that building next to the KPFA building houses only about 4 or 5 staff. It is the most logical asset that we have to sell. And that could go a long way to paying the Empire State Realty Trust. So maybe a combination of a loan along with the sale of that building would be the way to go.
What about the hire of a new executive director for Pacifica? What is happening with this?
Because of some very good work by the personnel committee and the board, we found a really excellent interim executive director. I think he's going to just be terrific. We really need turnaround management, and this person fits the bill. I can't give any more details about it because the board voted to hire him, but the announcement is pending the signing of a contract and a background check. I think the background check has been completed, so that's fine. And this person has just exactly the experience we need, a turnaround person who has a lot of experience with radio and public media. It's just a kind of a real find to find this person. So I am feeling very optimistic. He should be starting in a week or so.
Well, what about a long-term solution for Pacifica National and the management in general at the foundation? Now, couldn't there be a lot of improvement there?
Absolutely. I think, personally, my opinion is that the reason we're in this fix is because over a period of 10 or 12 years, there have been cuts in senior management of Pacifica. And I think that that's been a big mistake. We need to reverse what we've done. You know, what we've been doing hasn't worked, hasn't been working for us. Over a period of 10 or 12 years, there's been a slow, steady decline in listenership, in membership, and in revenue across all the 5 stations, the whole foundation. And part of the reason for that, in my opinion, is that the national office was diminished over time. Less and less authority was given to the national office, less and less money, the staff was cut. Now, it's just to me crazy to have an organization, a nonprofit, with over 150 staff members and have no strong executive director. That doesn't make any sense. And with an organization of this size, especially with our history of very destructive human relation lawsuits, we can't go with a weak national office with no human relations personnel or very little in terms of human relations staff. You can't have 150 employees and not have human relations director. It's kind of not logical, in my viewpoint, to have a national organization of this size and this importance not have a national development director. Also, we need a national programming director because on the local level, the program directors are too much influenced by the local programmers who really put so much pressure. Anytime there is any effort to improve the programming, there's a lot of backlash on the part of the programmers who besiege the general manager and the program director. So we need somebody external to the stations to monitor the programming and to ensure that it's improved. So over 10 or 12 years, instead of improving and enhancing national management, it's been basically decimated. I mean, we now have currently an interim executive director who's unpaid. He's been doing a job. He's a wonderful man, and his heart is with Pacifica, of course. But he is unpaid. That doesn't make any sense to me. Before this, we have a history of this recently. This does not make any sense. And during these 10 years, there was no pressure on the part of these interim executive directors to make sure that the books got done, to make sure that there was no theft on the local level, to make sure that our audits got completed. Nobody was paying attention to that because they didn't have time to do it. How much can you do as a senior executive of an organization this size if you're only doing it part-time as an unpaid person? It doesn't make any sense. So you don't amputate the head. You know, you don't leave a body like this headless. So first we need to make sure that we have better management in this organization and put in standard business practices. I think that staff deserve to be evaluated on a regular basis. And there needs to be personnel files so that if we decide to remove someone or demote someone, it's justified. Millions of dollars have been paid out by Pacifica for lawsuits based on wrongful termination, sexual harassment, all those kinds of things. So where we haven't paid senior management, we've wound up paying on the other end in terms of having to hire lawyers to deal with the lawsuits and also to pay out settlements. These decisions to decrease the budgets for senior management have not panned out for us. They've been very expensive in the long run.
Well, Grace Aaron, thank you very much, and thank you for all your incredible work on behalf of Pacifica.
Well, you're very welcome, and thank you also for producing really scintillating programming.
Something happening, yeah, yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with Grace Aaron. Today's show has been What Way Forward for Pacifica. Grace Aaron currently serves on the Los Angeles KPFK Local Station Board and the Pacifica Foundation National Board. She served on the Los Angeles KPFK Local Station Board from 2003 to 2009 and on the Pacifica National Board in 2008 and 2009. She was the chair of the Pacifica National Board in 2009 and the interim executive director of the Pacifica Foundation in that year. She is a longtime peace and anti-nuclear activist and currently is on the board of the Los Angeles branch of Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. She has been an active organizer for peace action for many years. She can be contacted at graceaaron@gmail.com. The Pacifica Foundation website is pacifica.org. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yaramako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
The following program deals with adult themes, including body image and sexuality, and it refers to body parts by their proper names. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to New World Notes, edited by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. A new edition of Gene Kilbourne's video, Killing Us Softly, is out, and the 10-year-old edition has been made available free to the public. The older version is still pretty darn good. It's an illustrated public lecture on the crazy and harmful depictions of women and sex in commercial advertisements. Kilbourne's critique is not especially radical, but I think it's very sound and very witty, and I think both men and women will appreciate the justness of what she has to say. I've condensed it slightly to fit our time slot, and of course, I've had to snip off the pictures. Here is Gene Kilbourne and the year 2000 version of Killing Us Softly.
Many years ago, I saw an ad that changed my life. At the time, I had a mindless job putting ads into a medical journal, and one of them was for birth control pills called Ovulin 21. And the ad said, Ovulin 21 works the way a woman thinks, by weekdays, not by cycle days. And the smiling woman, as you can see, has boxes in her head, and each box represents a day of the week. So Monday is washing day, Tuesday is ironing day. Now, this was a long time ago, but I knew there was something wrong with this ad. I couldn't exactly say what it was, but I knew there was something wrong. I took it home, and I put it with a magnet on my refrigerator. And then I began to collect other ads and put them up on the refrigerator, too. So soon I had a collage of ads up there. And as friends would come over, they'd say, what's this? And I'd say, well, you tell me. And we began looking at these images. And I started to see a pattern in the pictures, a kind of statement about what it means to be a woman in this culture. But I became very interested in the whole subject of beauty and of the image, of how much power it gives young women, but how short-lived and unfulfilling it ultimately is. And I kept collecting ads. In 1979, I made my first film, Killing Us Softly, which is still shown throughout the world. And in 1987, I remade it as Still Killing Us Softly. Now, here we are at the beginning of the new millennium. I want to look at what I said in those earlier films and see what's changed and what's stayed the same. In the original Killing Us Softly, I said that I would be asking of you something that no one has ever asked before, and that is to take advertising seriously. These days, we do take advertising more seriously. Advertising has increased from a $20 billion a year to a $180 billion a year industry. The average American is exposed to over 3,000 ads every single day and will spend 3 years of his or her life watching television commercials. Just the commercials. The ads, as you know, are everywhere. They're on radio, television, newspapers, magazines, billboards, bumper stickers. Here, one company brags about its ability to put advertising in your face all over the place. And at the same time, everyone in America still feels personally exempt from the influence of advertising. So wherever I go, what I hear more than anything else is, I don't pay attention to ads. I just tune them out. They have no effect on me. Now, I hear this most often from people wearing Gap t-shirts, but that's another story. It certainly is true, in fact, it's more true than ever, that advertising is the foundation of the mass media. The primary purpose of the mass media is to sell products. Advertising does sell products, of course, but it also sells a great deal more than products. It sells values, it sells images, it sells concepts of love and sexuality, of romance, of success, and perhaps most important, of normalcy. To a great extent, advertising tells us who we are and who we should be. What does advertising tell us today about women? It tells us, just as it did 10 and 20 and 30 years ago, that what's most important about women is how we look. The first thing the advertisers do is surround us with the image of ideal female beauty. So we all learn how important it is for a woman to be beautiful and exactly what it takes. Women learn from a very early age that we must spend enormous amounts of time, energy, and above all, money, striving to achieve this ideal and feeling ashamed and guilty when we fail. And failure is inevitable because the ideal is based on absolute flawlessness. She never has any lines or wrinkles. She certainly has no scars or blemishes. Indeed, she has no pores. If anything, this ideal image has become far more impossibly perfect in recent years through the magic of computer retouching. Computers can do many things. For starters, they can alter a photograph to make it perfect. According to this magazine cover, Michelle Pfeiffer needs absolutely nothing. Well, not quite, according to the bill from the retouching company that describes all the work they had to do to make her acceptable for this cover, such as clean up complexion, soften eye lines, trim chin, remove necklines. In addition to retouching photographs of real women, computers can create women who do not exist. A Mirabella cover featured parts of different women's faces, one woman's lips, another's eyes, another's nose, combined to form the perfect face. This wouldn't matter so much if it didn't connect with the core belief of American culture that such transformation is possible, that we can look like this if we just try hard enough, buy the right products. If we're not beautiful or thin or rich or successful, it's because we're just not trying hard enough. And the research is clear that this ideal image does affect women's self-esteem, and it also influences how men feel about the real women they are with. And women's bodies are still, in fact, perhaps more than ever, turned into objects, into things. And of course, this has very serious consequences. For one thing, it creates a climate in which there's widespread and increasing violence against women. Here she's become the bottle of alcohol with a label branded on her stomach. Now, I'm not at all saying that an ad like this directly causes violence. It's not that simple. But it is part of a cultural climate in which women are seen as things, as objects. And certainly turning a human being into a thing is almost always the first step toward justifying violence against that person. We see this with racism. We see it with homophobia. It's always the same process. We think of the person as less than human, and violence becomes inevitable. And that step is already taken with women. So the violence, the abuse, is partly the chilling but logical result of this kind of objectification. Now, this is a problem for all women, of course, but particularly women of color, who are often literally shown as animals, dressed in leopard skins, in animal prints. Over and over again, the real message is not fully human. Women's bodies continue to be dismembered in advertising. Over and over again, just one part of the body is used to sell products, which is, of course, the most dehumanizing thing you can do to someone. Not only is she a thing, but just one part of that thing is focused on. Most often, the focus is on breasts, since we are a culture that is certainly obsessed with breasts. And breasts are used to sell absolutely everything. The most dependable fishing line in the world. Women are constantly told we must change our lives by increasing our breast size, and the stakes are high. Does your husband wish you had larger breasts? And if he does, the implication is very clear. You better change your body, as opposed to changing your husband. 20 years ago, we were told to use creams and breast developers that were, of course, completely worthless. In ads like this, I really wanted a fuller bust line for summer. One wonders what she's supposed to do in the fall. And then we were told to wear uplifting bras, such as the Wonder Bra and others. If you've got it, flaunt it, and if you don't, create it. Now imagine if men were supposed to play this game. Wonder Jock, the strap for the bulge you've always wanted. But nowadays, we're supposed to have plastic surgery. Breast implants. The most important decision I ever made was choosing my spouse, the second my plastic surgeon. Most women who have had breast implants lose sensation in their breasts, so their breasts become an object of someone else's pleasure rather than pleasurable in themselves. The woman literally moves from being a subject to an object. And yet we all learn very early on that our breasts are never okay the way they are. Your breasts may be too big, too saggy, too pert, too flat, too full, too far apart, too close together, too A-cup, too lopsided, too jiggly, too pale, too padded, too pointy, too pendulous, or just too mosquito bites. But with Depth styling products, at least you can have your hair the way you want it. Now imagine being a young girl looking at an ad like this. It's clear from the copy that your breasts can never be okay. And the research indicates that the self-esteem of girls in America plummets when they reach adolescence. This doesn't happen to boys, but it does to girls. Girls tend to feel fine about themselves when they're 8, 9, 10 years old, but they hit adolescence and they hit a wall. And certainly part of that wall is this terrible emphasis on physical perfection.
The ad for Calvin Klein jeans shows a man's naked thighs and torso, no head. He's holding a small garment in front of his genitals, barely concealing them.
Men's bodies are rarely dismembered in advertising, more than they used to be. But this ad was so shocking that the ad itself got national media coverage. It's a good thing it got some coverage, I suppose. Reporters called me up from all around the country and said, look, they're doing the same thing to men they've always done to women. Well, not quite. They'd be doing the same thing to men they've always done to women if there were copy that went with this ad that went like this. Your penis may be too small, too droopy, too limp, too lopsided. Too narrow, too fat, too jiggly. Too pale, too pointy, too blunt, or just 2 inches. But at least you can have a great pair of jeans. And believe me, this is not the kind of equality I'm fighting for. I don't want them to do this to men any more than I do to women. But I think we can learn something from these two ads, one of which did happen and one of which never would. And what they show us very vividly is that men and women inhabit very different worlds. Men basically don't live in a world in which their bodies are routinely scrutinized, criticized, and judged, whereas women do. Now, this doesn't mean that there aren't stereotypes that harm men. There are plenty of stereotypes that harm men, but they tend to be less intimate, less related to the body. It's all probably summed up by this classic, a carrot or more when a man's achievement becomes a woman's good fortune. So the idea that women are just gold diggers, as in this Winston ad featuring this old man and young bride, she's after my money like I care. Now, so the stereotypes wound all of us. They wound women, they wound men, and they also make for pretty terrible relationships. But they are different. For women, the emphasis is always first and foremost on how we look, no matter what else we do. He said the first thing he noticed was your great personality. He lied. So the message that girls get early on is that it's never going to be your great personality that's going to be most important. And a body type that statistically 5% of American women have is the only one we ever see as desirable or acceptable. This is genetic. You can't diet yourself into this body type. Not for long, anyway, any more than you can make yourself taller. The models are very tall, genetically thin, although they often starve themselves anyway, broad-shouldered, narrow-hipped, long-legged, and usually small-breasted. So when the models have large breasts, almost always they've had implants. This is a body type that basically doesn't exist, but again, it's the only one we ever see. So no wonder there's such terrible stress on women and girls. The Body Shop made this point wonderfully with their recent ad, there are 3 billion women who don't look like supermodels and only 8 who do. And that's just about the truth. Basically, we're told that women are acceptable only if we're young, thin, white, beautiful, carefully groomed and polished, and any deviation from that ideal is met with a lot of contempt and hostility. You never thought you'd lose your looks either. And look at the kind of real contempt that there is for this woman who's portrayed as completely valueless now. These days, the greatest contempt is for women who are considered in the least bit overweight, as in this classic, I'd probably never be married now if I hadn't lost 49 pounds, which one woman told me was the best advertisement for fat she'd ever seen. primary message that young women and girls get in our culture today is the message in this ad. At the top it says, the more you subtract, the more you add. And in general, as girls reach adolescence, they get the message that they should not be too powerful, should not take up too much more space. Soon you'll both be taking up less space. Not to be too full of themselves, not to throw their weight around, not to be too powerful. So no wonder, given this, at least 1 in 5 young women in America today has an eating disorder, the most common of which are anorexia and bulimia. And if you think of an eating disorder as any kind of disordered attitude towards eating and one's appetite, it's probably closer to 4 out of 5. Now, where else could this image of thinness come from, if not, at least in part, from the media images that surround us and that tell us in order to be acceptable, we need to be painfully, unnaturally thin? And some of the ads that we see these days are more outrageous than ever before. Put some weight on. And this is an ad for the watch, which the woman is wearing on her upper arm. She is so thin that she's wearing the watch on her upper arm. And they're actually joking about that in this ad. Put some weight on. The obsession with thinness, I think, is really about cutting girls down to size, silencing them. So not only do we have images of very thin girls and women, we also have many, many images of girls in ads with their hands over their mouths, or worse, with her lips sewn together, or silenced in many other ways. And women of color in particular are supposed to shut up and to be barely there, just smiling the bothers away. Let your fingers do the talking. Endless, message after message.
Soft colors. Let your eyes be heard without making a sound.
And the body language of girls and young women is usually passive, vulnerable, get used, and very different from the body language of boys and men. So we have women typically posed like this, and men like this. And this starts so early. Look at this double-page spread from Calvin Klein. The incredible difference. The girl, again, her hand over her mouth. When girls are shown as powerful in advertising, it's always a very masculine definition of power. For girls with plenty of balls, very masculine indeed, and this is an ad for body lotion. Other times, the power that women are offered is silly and trivial. Live outside the lines. But what that means here is that she's able to use the men's room. What a great revolution. And this reminds me of an ad from my original film, an ad from the 70s that told women to relax and enjoy the revolution. And this ad was for flavored douches. It is completely ridiculous. It was then, it is now. But this trivialization of freedom and power for women and this co-optation of feminism continues. So the ultimate message that women and girls get remains, you have the right to remain sexy, which, according to this ad, really means the right to be a sex object, the right to be passive, the right to have our sexuality defined in a rigid, shallow, extremely limiting, and cliched way. Women are still told, as we were starting about 20 years ago, that it's sexy to be like a little girl because innocence is sexier than you think. Every detail is planned. The shape of the product, the way she's sitting, the fact that she's dressed like a little girl but she's got a cleavage. All of this is designed to send out a very powerful sexual message at the same time that it denies it, which is exactly what the ad is telling women to do. So for years now, for decades, we've been getting this message that we're supposed to be both innocent and sexy, virginal and experienced all at once. Now, as many of us know, this is tricky. And it's also insulting, because the real message is don't grow up, don't become a mature sexual being, stay like a little girl. And we're still getting this message over and over again. Nothing so sensual was ever so innocent. Grown women are infantilized in many ways through fashion and body language, ads like this, and images like this using a pacifier to sell lipstick. I spoke about the sexualization of little girls in my original film, using this image. And if anything, this whole situation has gotten worse. The sexualization of children and also particularly of young teenagers. Calvin Klein, of course, has brought a lot of attention to this issue quite deliberately by using very young models in a series of ads and commercials that were meant to be reminiscent of child pornography.
Can you unbutton the top button of those jeans? Now, why don't you push them down?
In the original version of Killing Us Softly, I said that the advertiser was America's real pornographer. And I used examples such as the Exciter, this ad for Tabasco sauce that says, add your own dash at the table. And as I said then, if this ad isn't saying that this bottle of Tabasco sauce is having intercourse with this baked potato, I don't know what is. Or this ad, whatever you're giving him tonight, he'll enjoy it more with rice. I don't think I'm particularly naive, but I haven't figured out yet what the hell you do with rice. You know, I don't know. Maybe it's wild rice. One woman shouted out the other day, she just hoped it wasn't minute rice. But the use of sex to sell everything is more blatant and pervasive than ever before. This is an ad for jeans, although something seems to be missing. The truth is that sex is both more important and less important than our culture makes it out to be. And yet, if you looked at the world of advertising, one would have the sense that there is nothing else but sex used to sell everything. In general, teenagers are hypersexualized in our culture today. A magazine for young women and girls called Jane has on the cover an article, 15 Ways Sex Makes You Prettier. A catalog for Abercrombie & Fitch, which is aimed, of course, at very young people, features the threesome. Again and again, kids being targeted and given messages like this. You can learn more about anatomy after school. The problem isn't sex. It's the trivialization of sex. It's the culture's pornographic attitude towards sex. When bondage is used to sell neckties in the New York Times, this says the right tie can make even the most casual evening more memorable, and there are ties on the bedposts. When bondage is used to sell perfume in the New Yorker and watches on a city bus, we can say that pornography has become mainstream. It not only trivializes that violence, it eroticizes it. Wear it out and make it scream. Now, this could be a seduction, but it could as easily be an attack, and it's certainly unnerving when we can't tell the difference. Often, violence, hostility, dominance is presented as erotic, as attractive, as appealing in ads and throughout the culture. Push my buttons. I'm looking for a man who can totally floor me, who won't stop till the top. You must live in sin. And think about it. This woman is extremely passive, vulnerable. She's in an elevator. We all know that elevators are dangerous places for women. And yet, she's asking for it. And there seems to be more of this than ever before. More ads that imply that women want to be forced to have sex. An ad for a perfume called Fetish, and the copy says, apply generously to your neck so he can smell the scent as you shake your head no. Making it very clear that we don't mean it when we say no, that she's, again, asking for it. There continue to be lots of ads that normalize and trivialize battering. And battering is the single greatest cause of injury to women in America. I ended the original version of Killing Us Softly with a slide of a horrifying display in a store window. It says, we'd kill for these. There's a female corpse in a shroud in a garbage can with blood on her face and a shoe across her throat. But today we still have images of brutality. Murdered women are sometimes joked about in ads. Imagine an ad like this with a woman being shot. Trivializing copy like this, great hair never dies. In so many ways, the more things change, the more they stay the same. Some of the original ads that I used years ago seem impossibly sexist and even quite hilarious these days. My boyfriend told me he loved me for my mind. I was never so insulted in my life. And yet, consider these current ads. A woman being used as a footrest to sell skateboards. In general, human qualities are divided up, polarized, and labeled masculine and feminine. And then the feminine is consistently devalued, which causes men to devalue not only women, but also all those qualities that get labeled feminine by the culture. And by that I mean qualities like compassion, cooperation, nurturance, empathy, sensitivity. We may give lip service to these qualities, but in fact they have very low priority in our society. And we all lose, and we lose very badly, when we're told that one gender can have only one set of human qualities and one gender only the other. We obviously end up being half or less of what we otherwise might be. And certainly this dehumanizes all of us, men as well as women. Advertising is one powerful force that keeps us trapped in very rigid roles and in very crippling definitions of femininity and masculinity. But as we've seen, we still have a long way to go. And the changes have to be profound and global. And what they will depend upon more than anything else is an aware, active, educated public that thinks of itself primarily as citizens rather than primarily as consumers. We need to get involved in whatever way moves us to change not just the ads, but these attitudes that run so deep in our culture and that affect each one of us so deeply, whether we're conscious of it or not. Because what's at stake for all of us, men and women, boys and girls, is our ability to have authentic and freely chosen lives, nothing less. Thank you very much.
Jean Kilbourne and Killing Us Softly, Advertising's Image of Women, Edition 3. For information on the new fourth edition of the video, check out the Media Education Foundation, www.mediaed.org. And for more information on the show or to send feedback, check out newworldnotes.blogspot.com. That's newworldnotes.blogspot.com. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Thanks for listening. You'll get to my non-carborundum and hope to see you again next week. Ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear the first part of a speech given by Dr. John McMurtry, author and professor of philosophy at the University of Guelph in Ontario, Canada. This is a very powerful speech and was given at the International Citizens Inquiry into 9/11 on May 30th, 2004 in Toronto. I was actually at that conference, but somehow missed Dr. McMurtry's speech. Someone shared it with me recently from hearing it on Bonnie Faulkner's show Guns and Butter on KPFA out of Berkeley, California. She aired it in March of 2010. And you can also find it on globalresearch.ca, where it was also posted in March of 2010. What you'll hear today comes from the Guns and Butter show. The title of the speech is Why the Facts of 9/11 Are Suppressed, with a subtitle called Understanding the Ruling Group Mind Behind the War Without End. So let's get started. Here's Dr. John McMurtry.
Thank you very much. The subtitle is Understanding the Ruling Group Mind Behind the War Without End. I think that we've ultimately got an instituted cognitive structure here that selects for not only 9/11, but what I will later call the 9/11 wars. And hence, I will explain it, beginning with the first section, Whose Reign of Terror? A quotation begins that, "The system works." Donald Rumsfeld. Civilized Americans were outraged at the torture of Iraqi prisoners by U.S. occupying forces when they found out about it. But not what started it all, the illegal war of aggression by the U.S. invasion of Iraq last year, the supreme crime under international law. Although it is reassuring that the corporate media finally broadcasts crimes against humanity instead of ignoring them, a crucial question arose in the face of the public relations onslaught by the Commander-in-Chief White House to spark American war fever again. Would the group mind slogans of the free world versus the terrorists fool the public once more? America at war had always worked before. At the height of this damage to America's image, note the focus of concern, the Patriot card was played again and again around the clock. That the Red Cross had reported that 70 to 90% of the torture victims were picked up at random and tortured for nothing they did not diminish cries for the terrorists' blood. That the official Taguba report was not permitted to question anyone above a part-time Reserve Army woman officer who was kept out of the interrogation room by U.S. Defense Intelligence did not register as evidence of top-down control. That the far worse crimes of continuously maiming and killing defenseless Iraqi women and children by U.S. and Allied bombing were not connected indicated that the murderous blind eye was still closed. The ruling group mind of America was only concerned about America's image abroad. Throughout, the deep pattern was overlooked, which tells all. That this U.S. regime obeys no law if it protects the life of people outside it. The examples are self-defining at every level. Sabotage laws of the Community of Nations from the Kyoto Protocol through the Rights of Children and the Landmines Treaty to trashing of nuclear bomb bans, covenants for economic sovereignty, and against racism and atmosphere destruction. Wherever one looks across the world's fields of life need, the U.S. presidential line of command constitutes itself as above the law, including the International Criminal Court itself, which it applies against others with righteous fury. Denial of any charge is the first response, and then attack on any who speak up. The Bush Jr. regime is a pure type of a long pattern of criminal lawlessness whose wheel within wheels of murderous operations is the seldom discussed U.S. defense intelligence, far more powerful than the CIA. The barbaric tortures in Iraq, which caused an international uproar in May 2004, had been internally and externally documented for the Pentagon since the previous year, but were ignored at the top until one thing changed. The pictures. The one thing the media public can understand were published by the mainstream media and made plausible denial no longer possible. There are no pictures of the 9/11 setup. Throughout, one rule remained intact. No one called the president or his directors liars. The latest big lie continued to be lost, as always, in disconnected pieces. In the background, 9/11 justified any violation of international and constitutional law as essential to the war on terrorism, the same justification used by the corporation-friendly Third Reich to invade other countries at will. Behind one corporate state was the precipitating Reichstag fire to declare war on all who stood in the way. Behind the successor military war state was 9/11. Both were based on transnational corporations working both sides. The 9/11 baseline to justify war on whomever one wanted, far more clearly than the Reichstag fire, was looked for long before the event. The Bush Jr. planners had already published the Lynchpin Proclamation, Project for a New American Century, a full year before 9/11 in September 2000. A public planning document in which the desired, quote, process of transformation for the U.S.'s world mission of, quote, full-spectrum dominance was made overtly contingent on, quote, some catastrophic and catalyzing event, like a new Pearl Harbor, unquote. If the process of global military dominance was not to be, quote, a long one, unquote. It should have come as no surprise, then, that the wish by the men positioned to enable 9/11 was granted, with formerly financed allies executing the long-announced attack on the World Trade Center. One former agent, Omar Abdel Rahman, having masterminded the first attack in 1993, financed by the U.S. in past times, and another, Osama bin Laden, the second in 2001. Understanding the 9/11 wars. Quote, this is from Brzezinski. It's a quote from 1997. So we've had a number of warnings before it happened, including from the regime itself. The United States needs unhindered financial and economic access to Central Asia's natural resources, especially the enormous economic prize of the natural oil and gas located in the region. But it will be difficult to fashion a consensus on foreign policy issues except in the circumstances of a truly massive and widely perceived external direct threat. Unquote. The deepest mystery of 9/11 itself is why the facts contradicting the official story have been silenced in public and media discussion, with even left websites refusing to engage the meaning. I had a debate with Michael Albert, for example, on ZNet, and he just avoided it continuously, the whole issue. The taboo against knowing the facts is here encoded into the identity structure itself. Even the plain fact that there was an unprecedented delay on 9/11 of standard plane intercept routines for over 70 minutes, normally 10 minutes long, until all the target buildings had been hit, still remains publicly unspeakable years later. No one denies the fact. But it is, quote, conspiracy theory to mention it. This is a dead silence operation of the ruling group mind that locks out all thought and evidence which do not fit its baseline presuppositions. Given the known pre-9/11 search by U.S. geostrategic planning for a publicly saleable reason to invade Central Asia and Iraq, as the Brzezinski forequote in the Project for the New American Century revealed to us, why do the media, citizens, and other governments continue to disconnect 9/11's strange occurrence from what it provided the ideal pretext for? Militarily imposed new control and access over Iraqi and Central Asian oil. specifically its supply and its sale and its access across the world's richest oil reserve. We knew of these aims before they were made fact. Why then, when these very major invasions then occurred one on top of the other after 9/11, the sole context within which they could have been sold as defensive, does even dominant left analysis refuse to connect the dots? In the U.S. itself, almost no one, including the heroic Noam Chomsky, engages the question. Even the recent most developed factual analysis among almost none features an exonerating title, the new Pearl Harbor. Even after years of known lying about Iraq by the Bush administration, why do the media and foreign affairs respondents still continue to block out all evidence substantiating the hypothesis of a constructed 9/11 attack? For obvious example, the anonymously blocked FBI investigations before 9/11, the ignored intelligence warnings from many foreign state agencies, and the immediately prior visit of the Pakistani intelligence ISI paymaster of one of the lead hijackers. Why are even the basics of physical science ignored in understanding the attack? The building collapses whose velocity of fall from plane impacts alone contradicts the laws of gravitation and engineering physics. Again, there is no counter evidence or argument. There is just disconnection from and between the facts across the left-right spectrum. Now, given the Bush administration's endless stalling, blocking, and attack dog treatment of those chafing at top level inaction before 9/11, including the FBI Director of Anti-Terrorism, John O'Neill, who died in the attack, and later the Bush administration's own official chief advisor on counterterrorism, Richard Clark, what more evidence is required for the wall of the unthinkable to be moved? How can the long-prepared plans for war crime invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq, which 9/11 alone justified to the public, not be connected across the dots by still-thinking people? How could anyone coherently believe that, quote, and this is John Kerry's quote, and he's a careful man, quote, the most crooked, lying group I've ever seen, unquote, about the Bush Jr. administration string pullers were somehow not in? How could you coherently think that they weren't in on what, quote, all the buzz in Washington as well as foreign intelligence circles were warning about right to the day? If many followed these warnings not to be in the buildings or on the relevant flights on that day, how could U.S. Defense Intelligence and the CIA not know? How could it happen if they did not? Consider the secret command coordination, which is everywhere at work in the U.S. national security state apparatus. Then think through the multi-level stand-down of preventative procedures which were essential to allow 9/11 to occur, and did allow 9/11 to occur, at every level from immigration to flight control to defense intelligence and the CIA. If one remembers the record of sacrifices of countless thousands of people to covert geopolitical strategies of which the U.S. corporate security state is known already to be capable, what could be the cognitive disorder which could block the recognition of these connected facts and their meaning? How can a normal intelligence really think that the Bush Jr. cabal of operators who have arranged the usurpation of the U.S. presidency and have waged a mass murderous war by false pretext with the very lead operators who have presided over death squads and criminal secret deals destroying countless lives since the Reagan era, how could we think they would be too virtuous to manipulate a long-planned event by familiar people which gave them unheard-of new powers? When they know from all experience that they can play the card of America at war against anyone who challenges the president and commander-in-chief, why would they reject the heaven-sent fulfillment of their known wish list by 9/11? The motivations for murderous crimes of state and successful distancing from them are the warp and woof of history. All Henry II required to murder the Archbishop of Canterbury was a question in front of those who served him. Would we not have to be foolish to assume that the power-corrupted men facing enmeshment in the greatest electoral scandal and business frauds in U.S. history and a sliding economy under their watch would just turn away from an allowing event which would reverse their fortunes? and unprecedented world powers at stake. Would it be rational for such men to turn down the greatest opportunity of history to establish the empire of, quote, full-spectrum dominance they planned on the basis of just such a fast-track event to save fewer lives? Would they do this to save fewer lives than 3 months of domestic traffic accidents? The corporate market calculus all lived by would not be deterred by such an externality any more than the oil business they come from is concerned about far more deaths from their pollutions and extractions. Yet there is a deep structure of consciousness at work beyond the beneficiaries, which denies even the self-evident, and all our media right here in Toronto are in on it, not consciously. There is a level of identity that operates beneath facts, and it is a structure of prejudice, prejudgment, which selects what facts are and are not seen or connected. One needs to remember here that the lead group of the Bush top secret team is much of the same personnel that presided over the smuggling of cocaine into the U.S. to addict Americans so as to illegally finance war crimes against Nicaragua, and before that plotted with and provided arms to the mullah dictatorship of Iran so that it held on to American hostages long enough for the election to be lost by Jimmy Carter to the Reagan regime. Even without this larger historical context in view, and it's the same people like Elliot Abrams and so on and Cheney who are involved, within which, in fact, Cheney and Rumsfeld have worked at the top from the beginning, what evidence in the real world does the mainstream of North America have to believe that the very same people in political networking who boldly stole the 2000 presidential election by overriding legal voting procedures and rode on Enron jets and criminally provided financing to get there, and who still try to push through a national energy policy secretly advised by the same fraudulent operators, why would we think they're above letting 9/11 occur to win world power for themselves? Why, most simply considered, is the most elementary known principle and question of forensic judgment, justice, in the face of any crime, qui bono, who benefits, suspended here on 9/11. Note throughout that no mass media in the U.S. or Canada, nor any Democratic opposition politician, including presidential candidate Kerry, raises the most basic of all issues, qui bono. What explains why the self-evident is unthinkable? There's something at work within and across people's consciousness as citizens and consumers which is not yet penetrated. Some form of instituted mind lock blocks out the normal first question. It would lead us to the first forensic hypothesis that there was a complicit blind eye to what maximally served this administration's self-interest above all and no one else's. But we know that the most obvious hypothesis has been prohibited from view on pain of a burning, quote, a burning necklace of fire around the questioner's neck, to quote Dan Rather's words. Even when all the evidence pointed in the direction of the most important news story of the era, and there was no counter evidence, such as hard losses suffered by anyone at the top of the most unaccountable and pervasive failure of the most advanced international security apparatus in history, still, the question remained publicly unspeakable. Why would the most basic forensic question and facts continue to be overlooked when only ever more gains for this ruling group and their oil men, military constituencies piled one on top of another from 9/11 on? Why would no one mention the vast and global new powers over nearly everyone which 9/11 reaped for everybody at the top of this corporate state cabal? Why would the most elementary logic of any normal reading of criminal intent and action, whose interests are alone served, remain unthinkable? That is the mystery. Not once anywhere in public discourse that I know of, not in one piece of an around-the-clock saturating field of media and learned messages, have the interests served by 9/11 for those in control been once named. So let us name them here. Open access to the world's formerly untouchable and greatest wealth resources. New command position over public financing for subordinate militaries and police apparatuses, not only in the U.S. but across the globe. Privatization of the world's richest publicly owned and state-controlled oil fields and the social infrastructures they support. Almost no mention of that. new declared right to suspend the historical basis of rule by law, habeas corpus, and whatever other civil rights are targeted. The CAUT has a nice analysis of this recently. New legitimation of a president who lost the election until a legal mass invalidation of votes by Bush state officials and a stacked Supreme Court overturned state laws for vote recount. Public diversion from the regime's known corrupt support and energy policy determination by the most criminally fraudulent corporate leadership in American history. Unprecedented new powers for price leveraging of oil supply. That's, you've got our price of oil right now, one can see what happens. And military services for, quote, a war without end. New police powers across borders to imprison without right of legal defense anyone deemed to obstruct an international trade or other meeting in the future, and in crowning glory, unlimited new rights of men with chicken hawk pasts to command everyone else in new ways with ever more fawning media attention as men of will of iron. How could anyone of sane mind not connect the staggering gains by these people to the same people's failures to protect against 9/11, which provided all the new powers? The problem of denial runs deep into the collective psyche. The anomaly to be explained is how in an open society of cynical market calculation, the most evident facts of ruling group gain at almost everybody else's increasing expense can be so successfully repressed. I can't believe that is the sign pointing back to the block behind it. Even the consuming public's insatiable desire to know the dark secrets of the rich and famous is here still. Something deeper than regime propaganda is at work. Those who believe that the in-group running the U.S. national security state could not possibly have been involved in 9/11 are, by self-admission, no longer connected to the issue of fact or truth. They move within a deeper regime of meaning which operates across individuals and classes and beneath reason. They are moved from underneath by a pre-scientific field of hysteria, denials, and projections which propelled two criminal invasions, war criminal invasions and occupations, and police state laws across the world in under 3 years. We confront here, in short, a primeval world of the group mind, harnessed to the global market's military juggernaut and a bottomless consumer maw that only desires more. With war fever as its moving passion, the atomized masses are made one in a salvational fantasy of self-proving triumph over the enemy, which is seen everywhere. All step to the march of the group mind's metaprogram by which experience and perception are themselves organized. This is the ordering framework of consciousness in terms of which coherence and meaning are found in whatever is selected for attack, however false the justifications or defenseless the victims might be. Even the doomsday bombing of innocent poor peoples on a constructed pretext is perceived through the prism of this ruling group mind as a war for goodness and freedom. This is an old pattern in American expansion of continental and global market power. But it becomes fanatic in a new way with the construction of 9/11. Few dare to see the propelling mindset behind. In the 9/11 turn, one stigma phrase has held the group mind in a set point of compliance that asks no questions. Conspiracy theory is the term of art for the silencing operation. Fear of ridicule does the rest. In consequence, the 9/11 attack has permitted what was impossible before it. It has allowed an illegitimate administration to transmute into Americans' patriot champion at war, above accountability and the rule of law. Defending America from another terrorist attack, quote, has in this way become a political blank check for corporate corruption of government with impunity, war criminal acts and threats across the Islamic world without limit, and attacks on civil rights and public commons everywhere. This is the theater of America's war without end, a war which bestows new rights to dispossess, intimidate, imprison, and kill those who oppose, and more deeply, ignore the world's increasingly grave environmental and social problems which deepen under the global market regime. It is a war which crosses oceans and borders, a fiat reality which blocks out any effective attention or policy to the global crisis and its systemic causes. It has captured not just one government and people as in past wars to divert populations, but the entire world, which is, quote, either for the U.S. or for the terrorists, unquote. The public sector is thereby rendered impotent in formation of social policies and infrastructure to meet the life and death problems of the failing global market paradigm. Many thinking people understand the geostrategic pattern at work here, but not the regulating mechanisms of the pathogenic group mind that orders every one of the steps. It is the system decider behind every false terror scare, diversionary tack, big lie and violation of international law since 9/11. It is its metaprogram. Its primary economic expression is global privatization of public resources by force as well as fraud. Terrorists instead of communists are the diversionary enemy. What is in fact attacked at every level and on the ground is any social formation which blocks access to the last great frontier for corporate exploitation and control of our epoch. Public resources and spaces of every kind, including thought itself. This is the code meaning of the Bush administration's endless mantra of our freedom. That is, freedom for full spectrum control or access to everything of priceable value with no outer or inner perimeter to its invasion. That's the key. The trigger cause of the U.S. war state is a 9/11 attack on America, quote, but its binding lie is freedom. U.S. investment interests and defense installations increasingly span the globe in the name of everybody else's liberation. 9/11 is the pivot on which it all turns.
You've just been listening to the first part of a speech given by Professor of Philosophy, Dr. John McMurtry, of the University of Guelph in Ontario, Canada. The title of the speech is Why the Facts of 9/11 Are Suppressed, Understanding the Ruling Group Mind Behind the War Without End. Tune in next week to hear the conclusion of that speech. It's 8 years since this speech was given, yet the war without end still blazes on. From Afghanistan and Pakistan to Iraq, then Libya, now Syria, and next Iran. And 8 years later, the facts of 9/11 still remain suppressed. But the 9/11 truth movement, in spite of being heavily infiltrated with lots of inside squabbling, has made tremendous progress in getting the word out about the lies and cover-up of 9/11 in both the Bush and Obama administrations. With 1,672 architects and engineers pursuing the truth and exposing the government lies, to the many professional organizations with websites like pilots, lawyers, media professionals, religious leaders, political leaders, military officers, firefighters, to name just a few, all demanding 9/11 truth, and the actors and artists with celebrities like Woody Harrelson, Ed Asner, Daniel Sunjata, Martin Sheen, and many more, all working on a movie to expose the truth, the perpetrators of 9/11 have to be getting a little nervous. So keep spreading the truth. Show 9/11 movies at your local cable access station. Talk to your friends and family. Let's collectively break through this suppression of the facts. If you want your civil liberties back, if you want to end the 9/11 wars, if you want to curb corporate power, if you want to stop the 1% from transferring more of your tax dollars into their accounts, and if you want to expose the corporate media as the voice of propaganda and misinformation that it is, exposing the truth about 9/11 is the one thing that could stop the madness. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
And later on, the New York for Palestine Coalition rally at Grand Central Station.
Mobilizing in defense of all the Palestinian children currently being detained by the settler Zionist state and demanding their release. But first, the recent provocative, sinister maneuvers by the Trump regime and Israel's far-right Likud party and how they have exacerbated the long-standing and ever-deepening crisis for Palestinian self-determination and the humanitarian tolls in the occupied territories. And we are delighted to have with us Richard Falk, Professor Emeritus of International Law and Practice at Princeton University, the former United Nations Human Rights Rapporteur in the occupied territories, and the author co-author of 20 books, including Chaos and Counter-Revolution, After the Arab Spring, and it is a pleasure to have you with us, Dr. Falk.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I'm almost always overwhelmed by the injustices heaved at the Palestinian heart, at the Palestinian homeland, by the forces in the United States. And I wonder if you can give us your thoughts on the recent provocative actions of the Trump administration and how important you think they are and their actual significance within a historic context. And that's a big task, but you're always up to it.
I was just thinking it was a big task. But first of all, on the fundamental level, there is a certain continuity between the Trump administration's approach and the approach of earlier presidents, which has been fundamentally supportive of Israel's expansionist policies and its oppressive administration of the occupied territories. It has altered in tone and in some ways given a green light to the more extremist vision of greater Israel that exists in Israel as a result of Trump's way of addressing, one-sided way of addressing the problem. Prior presidents always made the effort to seem as though they wanted a solution that was a political compromise fair to both sides. Trump has more or less abandoned that surface kind of presentation. As I say, underneath that surface was always a pro-Israeli partisanship. But here, that partisanship during the Trump period has gone to such an extent that I think more conservative Israelis and strong Zionist supporters are now thinking it's possible for Israel to declare victory in the conflict and to incorporate as much of the West Bank as they wish to have. The only thing that restrains them is the so-called demographic bomb, that is, the fear that they couldn't pretend to be a democratic society if they incorporate so many Palestinians that the Jewish majority is jeopardized. So there is a change, perhaps, that is substantively important in the sense that there is no plausible ground for Palestinians to participate in the kind of diplomacy that the United States was sponsoring ever since the Oslo Accords back in 1992, 93. And that, in a way, is not entirely bad because there was no real prospect that a fair peace could emerge from that diplomacy. And now the burden has shifted, I think, to governments other than the U.S., perhaps Europe, perhaps China, and civil society, which I think has been emboldened to be more militant in relation to the Palestinian agenda. Finally, I'd say that the experience of last month involving Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as the Israeli capital was a very divisive move from the point of view of the international approach to the conflict, which itself was somewhat suspect because it relied on this two-state solution, which seemed more and more unattainable. But what the Trump initiative did was to repudiate the internationalists' sense that there had to be a fair solution before the resolution of the future of Jerusalem could be agreed upon. And further, when that was ran up against so much opposition that the General Assembly proposed a resolution declaring Trump's initiative null and void, Ambassador Haley at the UN tried to intimidate governments by saying that the White House would be watching and that economic assistance would be jeopardized for any government that supported the resolution. And what ended up was a vote of, I think, 125-8, with those eight countries, aside from Israel and the U.S., consisting of small island republics in the Pacific and two Central American countries. Not one important country in the entire world, including the closest allies of the United States, France, UK, Japan, sided with the U.S. And so it was a geopolitical disaster in the sense that for no gain from the point of view of American interests, this kind of unfavorable, disruptive initiative took place that was pleasing to Israel, pleasing to Netanyahu, but of no help to either the cause of peace, the cause of stability in the Middle East, or even the rather objectionable effort of the Trump administration to escalate the confrontation with Iran.
Professor Falk, taking it one step further, as the Israelis then did or are doing, the Likud party went on record for the annexation of the settlements in the West Bank. And Netanyahu basically said, well, what does that do for the rest of the Palestinians in the West Bank? And he would say, well, we'll make a state minus out of that. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I think that's part of this effort to not entirely abandon some kind of Palestinian entity emerging out of a very unfair peace process and basically go along with a unilateralist approach that incrementally takes more and more of the West Bank and creates a ethnic transformation in Jerusalem with the objective really of incorporating both Jerusalem and the West Bank in its most valuable character with respect to land and water into the state of Israel and forgetting, trying to forget that Gaza exists because of the concern with the incorporating too many Palestinians, which would undermine the already thin claim of Israel to be a democratic state.
What's been intermingled in all of this is relevant to a piece that you wrote not long ago, Why the Two-State Solution Refuses to Die a Natural Death. And you say that despite all appearances to the contrary, those in the West who do not want to join the premature and ill-considered Israeli Victory Party are clinging firmly to the two-state solution amidst calls to renew direct diplomatic negotiations between the parties so as to reach, in the extravagant language of Donald Trump, the ultimate deal. Can you direct your attention to the issue of the two-state solution, or what you put out in many pieces is, aren't we better devoting ourselves to the nature of apartheid Israeli style as opposed to reviving a kind of Oslo style peace process?
You well summarized my basic position, which is if you are genuinely interested in peace between the two peoples, the first step to take is to end these structures of subjugation that are directed at the Palestinian people as a whole, and which Virginia Tilley and I, in a study sponsored by the UN, concluded constitute a form of apartheid that is a crime under international law. And what I believe is the case is that until you eliminate the or make a commitment to eliminate these ways of oppressing the Palestinian people as a whole, and that would include the refugees and those that are in involuntary exile, as well as those living under occupation or living as second-class citizens in Israel itself, until you make a commitment to the equality of the two peoples, there is no way of achieving a fair compromise. And Israel has done its best to make even the possibility of that fair compromise in terms of a Palestinian state non-viable. After the 67 war, they increased the allocation of territory to themselves from 55%, which the UN had agreed upon back in 47, and 78%. The Palestinians actually accepted that 78% as the basis of a really very pro-Israeli territorial compromise, but then Israel was showed no interest in that, and instead expanded their territorial reach into the 22% that was left to Palestine by establishing a couple hundred settlements with now, if you count Jerusalem, as many as 600,000 or 700,000 Israeli settlers. There's no possibility of having a viable Palestinian state without the elimination of the settlements, and there's no possibility of eliminating the settlements without having a civil war in Israel. So in my view, that notion that it is possible to negotiate diplomatically a viable, independent Palestinian state is just a illusion, because the international community doesn't want to give up on the Palestinians. At the same time, they can't challenge Israel in a more direct way. And so that it creates a very bad situation. But I do believe, as in the case of South Africa, that the first step is to admit or acknowledge that a system of subjugation based on race or ethnicity is unacceptable and must be dissolved as a precondition for a peaceful coexistence between ethnically distinct peoples. That's what happened in South Africa. They released Nelson Mandela, and they agreed to a constitutional transition that gave Africans an equal vote with the white Afrikaners and British settlers. And that was all done in a way that said, we recognize that the only way to have a transition to a sustainable peace is to get rid of apartheid. And I'm saying the same thing more or less applies to Israel, despite the differences in their situation, their history, their worldview, their geopolitical connections. There are important differences. But on this fundamental issue, do you want peace? In both instances, if your answer is yes, you have to get rid of this ethnic subjugation. And that probably means you have to give up the claim that Israel is the exclusive state of the Jewish people. It has to be a state within which there can be a homeland for Jews and a sanctuary for Jews, but you can't have a right of return for just Jews, but not Palestinians who had lived on the land for generations. That just won't be acceptable, and it will eventually flare up in some kind of political eruption.
Well, do you think on the basis of that the Palestinians will change tactics and demand citizenship in a new state, whatever you call it, Israel or Palestine or whatever, and demand full citizenship, and that is a one-state solution?
That is one alternative that's been increasingly discussed. In other words, there is, in effect, since 1967 and the occupation, a de facto one state. But the Palestinians, other than the minority in Israel, pre-67 Israel, the rest of the Palestinians are living in a condition of rightlessness. So the position of some liberal Zionists and some people that see no other solution is to say, let's accept the reality of Israel's domination of the whole of Palestine, but demand that Palestinians be given equal rights within that territory. But the problem with that is twofold. One is that it requires the Palestinians to abandon the dream of their own national homeland within their own place of residence for generations. And secondly, it rubs up against the Israeli anxiety about a Palestinian majority population challenging control of the state, a unified state. And so the thinking that dominates Israel is a one-state solution with some kind of qualified participation by the Palestinians over a long-term period. And there's no likelihood that any Palestinian leadership that has any popular base could accept such an arrangement.
And we're speaking with Richard Falk. And one of the questions that I wanted to raise was the issue of the United Nations and why it matters, of course, that it is subject to the also outrageous slings and arrows of the Trump administration. But why does it matter, and why does it matter even for the Palestinians?
Yeah, that's a very important question, Mimi. And I think that it matters because symbolic issues matter in international life. And the struggle for the legitimacy of Palestinian grievances is fought out within the UN. The UN lacks the capacity to modify behavior unless it has the support of the geopolitical actors in the world. I mean, the UN can be very effective, sometimes too effective, as it was in relation, let's say, to Libya in 2011, because the geopolitical forces backed the claim being made in the UN. But so long as the U.S. blocks effective action in support of U.N. policy recommendations, there is no way of implementing these U.N. resolutions. But it is a signal to a civil society and to governments that are so inclined that it would be legitimate for them to take action in opposition to what Israel is doing. What I'm really saying is that there's a there are hot wars and there are legitimacy wars. And the legitimacy war is being fought out at the UN and is being won by the Palestinians. Their challenge, of course, is to find ways to transform that kind of UN vote that they received in the General Assembly a couple of weeks ago into something that has political traction. And that remains to be seen, whether the Palestinian solidarity movement has grown sufficiently so that that kind of implementation in international society can happen despite the inability of the UN to do very much beyond these symbolic gestures.
I never can think of anybody better to speak to on this seemingly intractable dilemma, but for us, the dilemma really being to support the Palestinian struggle for liberation and to mobilize in defense of all of the Palestinian people. We have been speaking to Professor Richard Falk, who...
Thank you, Mimi, for your gracious words, and it's always a pleasure for me to be having the conversation with you.
But the pleasure is indeed all ours. And Professor Falk is the former United Nations Human Rights Rapporteur in the Occupied Territories and author of numerous books and a deep, abiding friend and advocate of Palestinian self-determination and for the Palestinian people. Professor Falk, our pleasure entirely.
Thank you, Mimi. Take care. Call me Richard.
Will do. And with that, we are going to go straight to the New York for Palestinian Coalition rally at Grand Central Station. It was both great fun to see how people commanded the space, took over the environment towards the end of supporting the Palestinian people, and with a specific emphasis on the issue of youth who were arrested, and that is Ahed Tamimi, a 16-year-old who has been arrested, is being held by the Israeli Defense Forces, and we want her released now. So let's go to Grand Central Station.
From Palestine to Mexico!
From Palestine to Mexico!
All the walls have got to go!
All the walls have got to go!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Ahed Tamimi!
Free, free Ahed Tamimi!
We are gathered here today to demand the release of Palestinian child activist Ahed Tamimi from Israeli Zionist dungeon! like we did to her. But are we going to let them do that?
No!
Are we going to let them do that?
No!
Every single time they so much as touch a hair on the head of one of our children, we need to be out here making the loudest possible noise that we can. We need to let Israel know that people are watching, that people won't stand for it. And that's why we're here today, to not only condemn Israel's atrocities against the Palestinian people and Ahed Tamimi, but stand for resistance in all aspects of Palestinian society in whatever shape or form it takes. We're also here to educate you, because there's a lot of misinformation going about this case, and if enough people knew what was going on with Ahed Tamimi, this crowd would be all of Grand Central Terminal. Every single person would join with us. Because any person that knows the truth about the Palestinian struggle stands on the right side of history. Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Ahed Tamimi!
Free, free Ahed Tamimi!
Free, free Ahed Tamimi! Educate you in this rally here so that we are able to take what we learn outside of the noise that we make today and make sure that everyone we know, everyone that's in our life, knows about Ahed Tamimi's case, because we can't rest and we can't stop putting pressure on Israel until they release her and until they think twice about touching one of our children ever again.
And that's what we intend to do, free Ahed Tamimi and her cousin, Nariman Tamimi, and all of the child prisoners being held by the Israeli Defense Forces in occupied Palestine. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
Was I gay, bi, pan, or some other label that I had never heard of? I tried on the different labels as if they were shirts, but nothing seemed to fit right. I thought that I needed a label to be legitimate.
I wrote God's Own Country on spec, and I just wanted to show the world a little bit of how I see my world.
To This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell.
Beijing court considers China's LGBT cyber chokehold, the genesis and exodus of the word queer, and a behind-the-camera look at God's own country. All that and more this week because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news interaffecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the 3 weeks ending January 6th, 2018. A court in Beijing has agreed to hear a challenge to the ban on queer content in online media issued in mid-2017 by China's State Administration of Press, Publication, Radio, Film, and Television. The agency issued the directive last June, restricting internet providers from streaming TV shows and films that depict what it called abnormal sexual lifestyles or behavior. Same-gender sexual attraction is lumped into 84 specifically banned subjects that include luxurious lifestyles, superstition, sexual assault, and incest. Regulators banned abnormal sexual relationships and sexual behavior from motion pictures and broadcast and cable television shows in 2015. According to Pink News, the June 2017 online ban led to 291 video streaming platforms being shut down and almost 10,000 journalists losing their jobs. The lawsuit was filed on January 3rd by 30-year-old Fan Chunlin after the regulator refused to respond to his public information request asking why it deemed homosexuality to be abnormal. While LGBT activists are not optimistic about a favorable ruling, expected in August, they say the case will raise awareness of LGBT people and that the agency will at least be forced to provide a legal rationale for the ban. China's seemingly schizophrenic bureaucracy decriminalized private consensual adult homosexual acts in 1997 and officially removed homosexuality from a list of mental illnesses in 2001.
The Taipei High Administrative Court rejected a lesbian couple's marriage equality bid on January 4th after a city agency refused to register their union. They're the third Taiwanese lesbian couple seeking recognition to be rejected by the court since October. It ruled this week that household registration offices have no legal authority to register the union of same-gender couples and pointed to the landmark decision by the island's Constitutional Court in May 2017, giving legislators 2 years to equalize marriage laws. This week's plaintiffs were among 30 lesbian and gay couples who applied to city offices in August 2014 for legal recognition of their unions. All were turned away, and three of the lesbian couples subsequently filed lawsuits. The Taiwan Alliance to Promote Civil Partnership Rights, which helped the couples file the lawsuits, issued a media statement lamenting the court's decision, but in also citing the Constitutional Court ruling, said it's now the responsibility of the government to get a marriage equality bill enacted.
The lawyer for a gay Singaporean doctor announced on January 5th that his client plans to appeal a court's rejection of his bid to adopt his biological child, who was born through a surrogate mother in the United States. The court refused to allow the adoption last month, ruling that the birth of his baby through a surrogate would not have been legal in socially conservative Singapore. The prospective parent's name has been withheld because the case involves a minor. The doctor's attorney, Ivan Chong, told reporters that the family division of the High Court in Singapore would hear the appeal, but that a date has yet to be set.
All eyes in Bermuda continue to be focused on Governor John Rankin, the Queen's legal representative in the British Overseas Territory. Lawmakers on the Caribbean island passed a bill in mid-December that overturned the marriage equality ruling issued by the nation's high court in May and created less-than-equal domestic partnerships for same-gender couples instead. But what is usually a routine royal assent has yet to be issued, and there does not appear to be a formal time frame for it. Rankin has been described as being between a rock and a hard place because marriage equality has been the law of the land in Britain and many of its other territories for a number of years. A spokesperson confirmed this week that the governor is continuing to consider the measure and is taking legal advice as appropriate. It's not that unusual for the governor to seek advice from the UK Foreign Office about the compatibility of a bill with international obligations. The governor is required to ensure that legislation is consistent with the UK's obligations towards any other state or power or any international organization.
The Irish News reported in late December that a marriage equality lawsuit is headed to Northern Ireland's Court of Appeals. Echoing the same idea advanced in other countries, that it is up to lawmakers and not the courts to create marriage equality, Mr. Justice O'Hara ruled in August that the European Union leaves it up to member states to decide the issue. The lesbian and gay plaintiff couples, Grain Close and Shannon Sickles, and Chris and Henry Flanagan Kane, respectively, were among the first to register their civil partnerships when they became legal in Northern Ireland 12 years ago. Both couples are now parents. Each said they believe civil partnerships would be just a first step and that they'd soon be converted to marriage. One of their attorneys said the couples have always been in it for the long haul, but that no one was expecting it to be quite this long. The prominent human rights firm, KRW Law, which is representing the couples pro bono, argues that marriage equality falls under Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights, which guarantees the right to a personal and family life. Demands for marriage equality continue to grow elsewhere. Lawsuits have been filed in recent weeks by queer couples in Namibia and Bulgaria.
A federal court ordered the Pentagon to open service to qualified transgender personnel no later than January 1st, despite President Trump's opposition. And yet another and still pending study of the issue being conducted by Defense Secretary James Mattis. Barack Obama's Defense Department thoroughly studied the issue and concluded in 2016 that opening military service to transgender people would not create an undue burden on the armed forces. It's anyone's guess what study conclusions Secretary Mattis will announce, apparently sometime next month, or what the fate of currently serving transgender troops will be. But lawsuits challenging the proposed ban are still active in a number of federal courts.
Donald Trump has suddenly fired all remaining members of his Presidential Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS. A half-dozen members had already resigned in 2017 to protest what they perceived to be the administration's disinterest in dealing with the disease. The remaining 16 were unceremoniously terminated 2 days before Christmas via a FedEx-delivered letter. No reason was given, and most council members expressed shock at the unexpected terminations. One of them, Gabriel Maldonado, executive director of the LGBT HIV group True Evolution, speculated during a conversation with MSNBC's Rachel Maddow this week as to why the entire Presidential Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS now has 22 empty chairs.
Like any council, we have differences of opinions. We have different ways of approaching public health and how we see HIV and AIDS policy. I would definitely say that many of us were contributing authors of the National HIV/AIDS Strategy, which strongly supported and was included with the Affordable Care Act. And many of us on the council had fundamental differences from the direction that this administration seems to have taken.
No replacements for the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS have been named.
Two fans who were arrested in Egypt in September for waving a rainbow flag at a Cairo concert by the progressive Lebanese rock group Mashru Leila, which is fronted by an openly gay man, have been released on bail. 28-year-old Sarah Hegazi and 21-year-old Ahmed Allah each paid 2,000 Egyptian pounds, about $113, according to a lawyer from the Arabic Network for Human Rights. It's not clear when their trial will be held. The small group of rainbow flag wavers were extensively covered and condemned by several media outlets. The government then launched its latest crackdown on LGBT people and institutions. Arrests for debauchery or sexual deviancy in the last few months of 2017 skyrocketed.
An Egyptian parliamentary commission on religion announced plans in late December to push legislation to make promotion of atheism a crime. The commission has concluded that atheism can cause mental imbalances that lead to same-gender attraction. The plan follows a second proposal to criminalize private consensual adult homosexual acts, which are not specifically against the law in Egypt. The bill calls for prison sentences of from 1 to 3 years. Critics have condemned it as the most homophobic proposal in the world because it could even jail someone for simply being in possession of a rainbow flag.
But finally, the late Sally Ride made history as the first, closeted because she had to be, American woman in space. The U.S. Postal Service unveiled a stamp in her honor in mid-December, in addition to stamps commemorating, among others, John Lennon and children's television pioneer Mr. Rogers. Sally Ride died in 2012 from pancreatic cancer after devoting her life to promoting education and space exploration. She posthumously came out and publicly acknowledged her surviving long-term partner in the obituary she authorized. Her portrait will join Harvey Milk's as out LGBT trailblazers to grace forever first-class U.S. postage stamps later this year. You remember postage stamps, don't you?
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude for the 3 weeks ending January 6, 2018. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
It was incredible to work on this film. I mean, all the process that we had and all the things that we had to do and working on farms. And this is the way I want to work, and this is the way I love to work.
Find out all that went into an international festival hit to make what comes out on screen so powerful later in the program. Screw the labels. Words we use to describe ourselves are changing as fast as our rapidly changing world. And one of Outkasting's young commentators finds good reasons to screw the labels, or use them, or both.
This is Outkasting Overtime, a special feature from Outkasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Hi, I'm Lucas, a youth participant in Outkasting's main studio in Westchester County, New York. On this edition, Outcaster Lauren talks about her experiences with labels. Labels can be helpful for some and limiting for others. Lauren, like many LGBTQ youth, had difficulty with labels when she was first coming to terms with her sexuality.
When I was 12 years old, I had a crush on a girl. I'd never liked a girl until then, and I did not know how to handle it. Some people come out immediately after they realize that they like people of their own gender. A woman might realize that she has fallen in love with another woman. Everything will click into place at once, and she will come out as a lesbian the next day. But for most people, it's a slower process, especially when you're in middle school. I was lucky enough to know that there were words for girls who liked other girls, and I was lucky enough to know that I wasn't the only one. But things didn't make sense immediately. I didn't know whether I was one of those girls, or if this was just a one-time thing. I didn't know whether I still liked guys either. All I knew was that I liked girls, or one girl, meaning that I was not straight. So I started to come out to friends as not straight. But it turns out it is quite difficult to come out as not something. People want to know more than that. Was I gay, bi, pan, or some other label that I had never heard of? I tried on the different labels as if they were shirts, but nothing seemed to fit right. I made scales in my head, counted up crushes I'd had on girls and crushes I'd had on boys. I tried to place myself on the Kinsey scale or as a percentage, as if you could really be 75% gay. I felt like I needed a label. There had been a few times that I had told people that I liked a girl, and they thought that I was just joking or I just thought that she was pretty. I thought that I needed a label to be legitimate. A year or two later, I stumbled upon the word queer online. The general definition of it that I found was not straight. But if you called yourself queer, you were no longer speaking in negatives. People from across the LGBTQ spectrum called themselves queer, and people like me, who were trying to figure out who they were but couldn't put a word on it yet, called themselves queer. If labels were shirts, queer was a big, comfortable one. I started to call myself queer. The first reaction that I got from this was negative. I had come out to an older person in my life who asked me, why would you ever call yourself that? I felt ashamed, like maybe I was hurting people without knowing that I was. So I did what I enjoy doing most. I researched. Queer is actually a really interesting word. There are a few theories about where the word comes from, but one theory is that it comes from a Proto-Indo-European root that I can't even pronounce. T-E-R-K-W. It means to twist, turn, wind, or cut. So it could be said that queer meant not straight before straight meant heterosexual. The word went through a few linguistic changes before eventually becoming the Scottish word queer. It gained the meaning of different, although it usually meant different in a bad or strange way. Around the beginning of the 20th century, it began to mean homosexual, and by the mid-20th century, it solidified its definition as homosexual in a derogatory way. So, when did things change? In the 1980s, the activist group Queer Nation emerged. The group hoped to be shocking. They believed that it was necessary at that point in time. They also wanted to reclaim the word queer, to take it back from the people who had used it against them. The slogan, "We're here, we're queer, get used to it," became popular, and queer studies became an academic field. Older LGBT people often have negative feelings towards the word, as it was used frequently to bully them in their youth. But for me, and many young people, this experience was not shared. The first time that I heard the word queer, it was from the LGBT community, while I mostly heard gay used as an insult growing up. That doesn't mean that the word carries no historical weight. Everything does, and it is understandable that it causes pain to some people. But it can be helpful, too. My current feeling about it is this. I can use it to refer to myself, but not anyone else. I also started to refer to myself as bisexual, which has felt more comfortable as time has gone on. But another thing has changed, too. As I've grown up and become more confident, I felt less and less that I need a label. It is helpful to have, for coming out and for dating, but at this point it doesn't feel as important as it used to. I will use one label for months, I will switch among three in the same conversation, I will tire of words completely and just kind of exist. A label can change what people see, but for me, it no longer has the power to change what's on the inside.
Thanks for listening to Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Outcasting is heard online at outcastingmedia.org, on iTunes, and on more than 50 public radio stations around the country. Outcasting Overtime is a production of Media for the Public Good, a nonprofit organization. Our assistant producers are Alex Mintz and Josh Valley, and our executive producer is Mark Sofis. Visit us at outcastingmedia.org to get information about Outcasting, watch Outcasting videos, access our social media links, and listen to Outcasting and Outcasting Overtime. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
Follow your favorite international LGBT radio show on Twitter at TWO Radio, read our blog at twopodcast.blogspot.com, and check out our fan page at facebook.com/thiswayoutradio. There are also links to all three at thiswayout.org.
Is God's own country England's Brokeback Mountain? Entertainment correspondent Steve Pride weighs that question with its creator and co-star.
God's Own Country is a stunning gay love story of both brutality and tenderness, set in the rustic hills of West Yorkshire in the UK.
I'm Francis Lee, and I am the writer and director of God's Own Country.
My name is Alex Carano, and I'm an actor. I'm one of the two leads in God's Own Country.
God's Own Country is primarily about Johnny Saxby, who is a Yorkshire sheep farmer, and he is running the farm on his own because his father's had a stroke and his grandma's quite old. All his friends have moved away to university or college or got jobs in towns, so he's very isolated, very lonely. He's shut down emotionally to be able to continue the work and keep the farm going. It comes to spring, and all the sheep are going to give birth to their lambs, and he can't do it on his own, so his father employs a Romanian migrant worker who's in the UK looking for work to come and help him, and it becomes about their relationship.
What inspired this?
The starting point for the film was the landscape, really. So I grew up on the hills in Yorkshire. I left when I was 20. I escaped to London to train as an actor. But I could never get that landscape out of my head. It felt to have totally informed who I was emotionally and physically. And so when I was thinking about stopping acting and making film, it just felt like a place that I had to investigate, that I had to explore. and also to represent those people that I knew so well from that area. I've only been making film for about 5 years. I got to a certain point in my career as an actor where I was very dissatisfied. I'd fallen out of love with it years before. I wasn't doing work that I felt was challenging. I always wanted to tell stories, and I had always seen the world visually. I'd been an obsessive stills photographer, but I'd never been confident enough to actually say that or to sit down and write anything. And I got to a certain age and thought, I'm going to have to do something. So I gave up acting. I got a job in a junkyard and started to write. And I wrote 3 short films and self-financed those by the job in the junkyard. And while I was doing that, I had this idea. I was exploring this idea of landscape, as I said, and the people who live on this hillside that I know so well. And so I wrote God's Own Country on spec. I just sat down and wrote it. And I just wanted to show the world a little bit of how I see my world.
Alec, when you first read the script, what connected with you?
I think it was one of the most detailed scripts that I've ever read. Every single glimpse and every single gesture that you can see in the film, it was written in the script. That made me really connect with the characters and with the story, and it's a very beautiful and powerful story. Of course, after I read the script, I really wanted to meet Francis, and I got a chance when he came to Bucharest to audition to see 14 or 13 Romanian actors, and we worked together for half an hour or 45 minutes, and I really understood that he knew what he wants from this story and from this film.
How did you prepare them for what was not just acting, but some very difficult and specific farm work?
I worked with both Josh and Alec, who played the leads in the film, for about 3 months before the shoot, and we worked primarily on the characters in that period. We started from the moment they were born until the moment we meet them in the film. And we worked through everything, not just on a timeline, but also in terms of relationships, family relationships, friends. Every single little detail about these men we discovered and we learnt and we worked on. Right down to if they had sugar in their tea, what socks they preferred, everything. So by the time we got to the actual shoot and Alec and Josh came to the set, they were totally immersed in their characters. So then for 2 weeks before we started the shoot, I sent them to work on farms because I knew I never wanted a stunt double or a hand double. I never wanted to be pulled out of this film with fakery. So both actors went and worked on 2 separate farms, and they worked long, solid shifts. And they would start early in the morning and they would end their shift late at night, and they learnt to do everything. They learnt how to birth lambs. They learnt how to build walls. I mean, they literally learnt everything. It was really important to me that they embodied these characters both physically and emotionally. And there's such a impact that working that way has on somebody physically. They got cold, they got wet, they got miserable, and these were all great things for me because that's what the characters were going through. So again, by the time it came to shooting the scenes when they had to do the farm stuff, both of them were totally proficient, as if they'd been doing it their whole entire lives.
You shot this chronologically too. Explain why.
The script very much felt like each scene acted like building blocks in this relationship. I love actors, and I will do anything I can to support them, to get the very best out of them, and to facilitate their work. And so it felt really important to me that if I could shoot chronologically, that would really help the development of their relationship. It also added this extra benefit. The way in which the film is structured, Alec's character, Gheorghe, isn't there at the beginning of the film. So I could keep them apart. And as people, Josh and Alec wouldn't get to know each other very well. So they wouldn't have developed that comfortable kind of relationship. And for me, that was going to translate on screen. So the first time they meet on screen, not completely, but it was almost the first time they kind of had worked together. So there was that extra layer of kind of tension or nervousness that I thought would just add a little bit of extra something in the scene. Once the relationship between the two boys develops, I move them both into the same house, and they built this beautiful, lovely, caring friendship between them. And again, that translated onto screen. So anything I could do to enable that, to make it feel richer and deeper, I did.
Alec, as an actor, did filming in this way make it easier or more difficult?
No, it's a lot easier. I mean, you can't find this kind of work with many directors. And it was incredible to work on this film. I mean, all the process that we had and all the things that we had to do on working on farms and developing our characters from scratch and discussing about them and knowing their lives from the point they were born until we see them on screen. And this is the way I want to work and this is the way I love to work. And Francis did an amazing job in creating this environment and letting these things happen.
At one point in the film, you put your arm inside a cow and later you birth a sheep.
Yeah.
At least now, though, you have something to fall back on if this acting thing doesn't work out.
Yeah, yeah.
I think Alec will be fine in the acting world. I'm hoping, and I know he isn't going to need anything to fall back on.
God's Own Country is being called the UK Brokeback Mountain.
I'm really super flattered by the Brokeback comparisons. I think it's a masterpiece in storytelling, and Ang Lee is an incredible storyteller. And those are phenomenal performances at the heart of it. I think this film is different. Brokeback is about sexuality. It's about society's attitude towards sexuality at that very specific time. Whereas I do think this film is more about love and about the human condition, which feels slightly more universal, maybe.
This has been a conversation with writer-director Francis Lee and actor Alec Saccarano about their film, God's Own Country. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Program material this week came from Wenzel Jones and John Dyer V, produced by Steve Pride, Outcasters Lucas and Lauren, produced by Mark Sophos and Steve Pride. Rachel Platten and Patrick Wolf performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors, who make this program possible. You can continue the groundswell of year-end support at thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KMUD, Redway in Garberville, California, 2CCC, Gosford, New South Wales, CJLY Nelson, British Columbia, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. In 1949, a group of pacifist anarchists brought to the air a radical experiment beholden neither to commercial interests nor to state funding, the model of listener-sponsored radio. Their maverick experiment, which started at KPFA, eventually led to what might be called an accidental network, encompassing five stations in key metropolitan areas, along with the San Francisco Bay Area, New York, Los Angeles, Houston, and Washington, D.C. But as visionary as the Pacifica Network was, it was beset by trouble from its early days over how it should be governed. KPFA started out as a worker-run collective. Later, Pacifica was overseen by self-perpetuating boards, a model that blew up in the late 1990s when listeners by the thousands came out to protect their radio station from a centrist takeover. Out of that crisis, a new hyper-democratic structure was put in place, designed to prevent another takeover from happening. But arguably, it's led to the possible terminal crisis of Pacifica today. Extremely costly and plagued by intense infighting and parochial interests, as well as low listener participation, a paralyzed listener-elected board structure has brought the sister stations of Pacifica, and potentially Pacifica itself, to the brink of ruin. In November of 2016, the Empire State Realty Trust successfully sued Pacifica station WBAI for $1.8 million in back rent. The Pacifica National Board has not come up with a viable plan for keeping the New York Corporation from seizing Pacifica's assets, and KPFA and its sister station KPFK in Los Angeles face the possibility of being forced to shut down if their operating money is raided. To make sense of what has brought this storied network to the edge, we're going to look at its history and present plight. I'm joined by Sherry Gendelman, who was a plaintiff in one of the lawsuits against Pacifica in 1999 and later served as the chair of the Pacifica National Board and as interim executive director of Pacifica. I'm also joined by radio historian Ian Bull. Ian, Can you start by telling us about the origins of KPFA? Under what circumstances was it started?
The context for the origins of Pacifica go back to the global crisis, the planetary crisis, capital's major crisis in the mid-20th century. And you were saying it was a kind of accidental product. In certain ways, that's true. It emerges, it's the brainchild, really. We can talk about three founders. Lewis Hill is the best known, and he certainly was already in radio, as was Eleanor McKinney. And Lou Hill was a conscientious objector. He was the son of an Oklahoma millionaire, part of the Phillips fortune. And he went to Stanford. He became an existentialist. He fell in love with Parisian existentialism. And actually, his model for the radio station, given that he realized that as he put it, the Gestetner isn't going to do it. In other words, the small magazines, the catastrophe of the Second World War clearly had failed in a certain way. And he proposed, on the basis of the same impulse that Dwight MacDonald, a radical sociologist, MacDonald said, well, we need to have big effects. In other words, he was thinking large, not local. And that will come back, in a way, has come back to haunt us, and we'll get back to this. He, in 1946, drew up a plan. Pacifica is a foundation that begins as a radio station in Berkeley and on air in 1949. That's already there's been a certain failure in his view, because they wanted to use amplitude modulation, which would allow from Berkeley broadcasting to reach the shipyards in Richmond and around the Bay Area. He was warned by fellow conscientious objectors as he began to plan this from Washington, D.C. He began to plan it as I say, with large effects in mind. It was a major blow, which was anticipated by his comrades in the antinomian, anti-war, pacifist movement, who were dedicated to taking an anti-statist position, who said to him, now look, Lou, if you want a radio station, that's going to mean licensing by the state, and that's going to cause a problem. And indeed it did later. He went ahead. He was not given an AM license, but he did manage to get a frequency modulation license. Now, FM, for those of you who are know about the history of this technology, was very recent. It was invented in 36 by a man called Armstrong. And it was sort of blocked for reasons that those of interested in the history of invention, it's a very normal thing. The RCA didn't like the idea very much. Early television, it looked like it might be sort of competition. And there was almost nobody who could listen to it. Its range was very, very short. It was basically radically local. It was like a micro station to begin with. How was it going to be funded? Well, he was going to go to foundations, and he was going to get it. It was a sort of a non-profit, set up as a non-profit. And he indeed, in the mission statement originally, and this is important, he wanted it sustainable. Now, that's a question we've got to come back to. They go on the air in 49. It's based on his experience as a student of philosophy. It's very fascinating that the early programming, it's clear that the radicality is not just the voice of conscience coming over the airways to those who were living on the hillside here in Berkeley in 1949. But it was not, in a standard way, a community radio station. Not at all.
What was the relationship between KPFA in those early days and the rest of the left? Initially, as you're describing, although there was a hope that KPFA would be founded to broadcast to the industrial shipyards of the Bay Area. It was not meant to just be a highbrow station for educated elite people in Berkeley. There was some intention of it getting beyond that. But in fact, as you said, partly because of the technology initially, they actually had to give away receivers so people could receive the station because of this new technology, FM. And certainly the notion, this kind of avant-garde, anarcho-syndicalist group of people who started the station, they were not connecting to a mass audience in those years. How did they see their relationship to the larger left, and how did that change into the 1950s, into the 1960s, into the 1970s?
Yeah, so the history from 1949 through for the next 25 years is a fascinating one. There's a kind of there's a slow transformation as it becomes a community radio station. They knew that under the current situation in during the witch hunts, that the state and the government was going to be coming after them.
You're talking about under McCarthyism.
Under McCarthyism, they had to protect themselves. They knew that those communist fellow travelers, anarcho-syndicalists in the union movement, were all under tremendous pressure. AFL-CIO had made the kind of historic compromise so that it became a question of terms and conditions. A lot of the dialogue in Pacifica cut much deeper than that, to the question of the basic question of organization of work. In their own work practices at the very beginning, that's a very small operation coming out of, you know, University Avenue, and they were, as Dick Moore said, they were syndicalists. They were very interested in keeping up with developments in the world of work everywhere, but there was already a crisis. The first major crisis was full-blown in 1954. And the warnings that were given from the beginning by some of the anarchist comrades said, you know, well, the state, you've got to watch the state. It's going to come after you. And it did. Because of the form required, the bourgeois form, if you like, the fact you have to be licensed by the state even to go on the airwaves, the victory that you didn't have to register the typewriter, let alone the press, that was won in the Anglo-Saxon world as far back as the 17th century. Basically, censorship broke down in the 1660s. And you know, that this is why Thomas Paine and co, it was very precious for them that they could have a free press. The origins of radio suggest that the state is there very early on. De Forest, for example, who invents the triode and the sort of the conditions which allow for the amplification of the voice across great distances. Immediately, the military are involved because it happens around the time of the First World War. By the time you get to the early 60s and the movements that we call the 60s and the counterculture in the Bay Area, the license that is granted quasi-accidentally, or sort of, you know, you're going to have the FM license, things begin to change because frequency modulation is used notoriously on college campuses and elsewhere for the background audio to the social revolution that is happening, music. It's not long, of course, before commerce comes in. And I should just say that we've got to think now, when we come to talk about the situation going forward, we have to think of you know, Google and Amazon basically as advertising companies, you know, with an IT section. And that means, you know, we're raising the question of where, you know, how do you fund this? And that was always, I mean, Lou Hill's guess was that I can't go straight to unions because to ask for support because, you know, how many members can hear this stuff? It was more like a small subscription magazine. And he made this bizarre guess that, you know, when people said, well, for heaven's sake, What about the free rider? Why would any Americans subscribe to a radio station which they can hear for nothing? And he said, well, why do people subscribe to a magazine? They know that it's only because they subscribe that it exists. So he made a guess that, you know, if 2% subscribed. And by the way, they went off the air within a few weeks, and it was only an astonishing turnout to them of, you know, some maybe a couple of hundred people here in Berkeley when they went off the air, when you know, after a few weeks, and the hat went round that gave them the impetus to say, well, something's happening, we're doing something, let's keep going.
Well, that question about the political economy of radio, of public radio, is at the heart of the story as it progresses up until our point, and just that wider question of how is media funded and what are the consequences of how media is funded. And so KPFA launched this model that was then replicated elsewhere of subscriber-based funding that's not dependent on the state and not dependent on commercial interests. And then from KPFA, this then was taken up elsewhere, but KPFA spawned a network kind of piecemeal put together. Two of the stations were acquired or came into the Pacifica umbrella in the late 50s, early 60s, the other two in the 70s. So KPFK in Los Angeles, WBAI in New York in 59 and 1960, and then I think it's 1970, WPFW in Washington, D.C., and 1977, KPFT in Houston, and that is the Pacifica network there.
Right.
With enormous potential, these five stations have the potential to reach a quarter of the U.S. public. But there was no master plan at the beginning to create a network that would have this reach. Can you tell us the story of how WBAI became part of Pacifica?
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. And it exemplifies your point exactly, that the accidental nature of it, you know, a network that's sort of cobbled together. And the fact that today we have a... It is a network, but barely working as a network should. I think we could agree with that. Eleanor McKinney, who was one of the triad, in the founders, she got a call one day in 1959 from Louis Schweitzer, who offered to donate his New York station that he owned to Pacifica. You could own stations, the privatization of the airwaves, the enclosure of the airwaves, goes back to all the way back to the beginning, to Key Telecommunications Act in 1927 and 1933. Later we'll come back to talk about the fateful Telecommunications Act of 96, which led to the millennial crisis. In 59, he calls up California because he was horrified by what he regarded as the crass and ingrained commercial mentality of the BAI management, that he couldn't shift. He could do nothing about it, he said. Now, he was an eccentric who made a fortune in paper manufacturing. And actually, the radio station was a kind of hobby for him. He was a kind of leftist. As a boy, he had fled the Tsar's regime in Russia. And his interest in the audio arts, Eleanor told me that, you know, when she had the second conversation on the phone, she was astonished at the congruence between his vision and the ones that the founders had. And so that captivated her, without thinking too much about how this would work as a network. She in this, at that time, she was on her own. I mean, Dick Moore had left in the 1954 saying, I'm out of here. I cannot deal with the liberal coup at the station. His sort of radical poetics. He ended up staying in documentary TV, going out to Minnesota, and working in San Francisco before that. But he'd gone. Lou Hill had killed himself in perhaps out of depression, but also his terribly painful illness in 57. And essentially, Eleanor went off to New York to run WBAI. and work on the transformation of a station in New York with its massive earprint, as it were, in the direction of the Founders Manifesto. We're going to have to talk now, soon perhaps, about how much of the problem we face now is, as it were, based in New York, and how much, in my view, about the governance structure that came out of the crisis brought on by the Telecommunications Act. So we have some structural questions here, as well as the kind of accidental nature and the way in which the strange troika and the culture of the Bay Area, happened upon this sort of FM model, which attracted a bizarre, strange paper manufacturer in New York.
I'm speaking with historian of technics Ian Bull. My name is Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And we're discussing the origins of Pacifica, which come out of the founding of KPFA Radio in the San Francisco Bay Area, and the crisis that Pacifica is facing right now, which could end up shutting down KPFA or one of its sister stations. I'm also joined by Sherry Gendelman, who is a lawyer and an activist. Sherry, obviously we're skipping over a lot of history here, compressing quite a bit, but the question of the funding of the network and then the governance of the network have been complicated questions. While KPFA and Pacifica birthed this notion of listener-sponsored radio, the way that a radio station and a radio network that drew its support from listeners would be governed proved thorny. At the beginning, KPFA was founded as a worker collective. Later, there were a series of appointed boards. And then in 1999, there was a crisis that had been brewing through that decade that had that question at the center of it. I wonder if you could actually describe for us what happened at that time. Well, and we will also discuss, following that, how that crisis may have led to the current one.
So what happened at the turn of the most recent century, from the late 90s to the early 2000s, was that radio and the value of radio and the consolidation of radio were at its highest point. Even this five licensees network was extremely valuable, maybe $750 million, maybe $1 billion at that time. And it was attractive for many reasons to center and slightly left of center sources in the community. And but I want to emphasize at that time that listeners donated and were subscribers and not members. What KPFA and Pacifica now labors under and suffers under is a structure that was created after several lawsuits were filed to protect the network from the centrist political people who tried to take it over and modify it into a NPR light. I don't know how NPR could get any lighter than it is. At the time, the network still was run by people who had some idea of management and of media. But it also occurred at a time when media was changing, as Ian mentioned earlier, going from terrestrial to some form of digital internet dominance, which is what we experience today. And what happened then was that there was a group of people identified as Democratic Party centrists or hacks who attempted to insinuate themselves into the network and to take it over. And there was a community reaction against that. And in 99 and 2000, the community support for KPFA, for instance, was so strong and so overwhelming that 10,000 people took to the streets of Berkeley when the final act of aggression by this centrist group who tried to take over the network was to fire an extremely popular and extremely competent station manager, Nicole Sawaya. And that final gesture, though there were many more aggressions against the station, galvanized the community in support of the protesters and in support of the people who were opposing this takeover by this centrist group of people. Several lawsuits were filed. There was a relator lawsuit filed by Carol Spooner, who got was granted status from the Attorney General of California to protect the certain listener interests. There were suits filed by some of us who were members of the various local station advisory boards, and I was one of the plaintiffs in one of those lawsuits, and our lawyer at that time was Dan Siegel. And there were other lawsuits that had been filed in an attempt to oust this group of people and gain control of or retain control of the station. And those legal battles and the struggles, I mean, there were people camped in front of the station, and there were arrests and there were accusations of the most dramatic and outrageous stories that were told. But eventually, those people, the various lawsuits, the three lawsuits that were filed, and the people behind them prevailed. And we were able to oust the centrist group that attempted to take over the network. The problem then became that the court identified a period of time for the activists to create a set of bylaws. And by then, the idea that was promoted that this is a membership organization and that the members have to run it with no qualifications other than that they be members. And there were certain political requirements. You had to have a certain number of women and a certain number of people of color, and you had to. But nowhere in that mix was there a requirement that you have people who knew how to run a media network, people who knew how to manage other people, people who knew the art of media, which was an art in and of itself and an art in rapid transition. And accusations among and between the different activists, the different members of the different lawsuits, the acrimony in those groups of litigants and supporters of Pacifica and KPFA just reached an astronomical level. Many of us, myself included, had lives to get back to. I was a practicing attorney. I did a lot of other things in the community. Barbara Lubin ran the Middle East Children's Alliance. I know Van Jones floated through the whole crowd of people and floated on out. And there was a group, there was a lot of arguments among the group, many of whom wanted to create this super democracy structure so that every voice would have a say, and every voice would be equal. So we left. I was opposed to a democratic structure. I wanted the best that I would agree to during the formation of this recent governance structure was perhaps half of the boards be elected, but the other half had to be selected for the talent that was necessary to raise money or to manage a station, and talent that was needed to address the real profession of media broadcast. And I was, and others who felt the same way that I did, were driven out and also drove ourselves out because I did return to my life. Unfortunately, that left people who determined that they would create a governance structure that they described as a super democratic structure. It wasn't a collective. It wasn't anything like the Spanish examples of that. It was super democracy. And what it resulted in were these extremely costly elections, costing the network $500,000 every 2 years of listener money. And listeners were giving us money for media and for programming. But now the money was being drained into elections with, you know, voter-ranked choice And there was a 26-member national governing board that was created. I don't know if anybody in the listening audience has been even on a board with eight people and what a challenge it is to get something done. 26 people being flown across the country and elected every other year and fighting with each other. The other, think about the structure that Pacifica suffers under now, is that every station has the same number of people. So, for example, if there are 800,000 people in Oklahoma and they have two senators, in California, the now largest state in the union with 40 million people, we have two senators. Well, the same goes for New York, who I think are down to zero listeners. They can't pay their bills. They have programming on the station that sells snake oil, basically. They are constantly in fund drives, and they are draining the network. The needs of the New York station, because of the population density of New York, are that in order for WBAI to be able to transmit its programming, it must rent a transmitter at a particular elevation to broadcast above the population density in huge buildings in New York. And so they entered into a contract with the Empire State Real Estate Trust to use the transmitter atop of the Empire State Building at now $60,000 a month. They have no listeners. They don't generate income. And they now have as much say in the direction and financial decisions of this foundation that KPFA does, KPFA now being the most successful, most listened to station in the network, and back then being the most successful station.
And yet even KPFA, even having, say, a disproportionate number of the listening and membership base of Pacifica, has in this current governance system a situation where people can be elected to represent the KPFA members with a very small number of votes.
With a very, very small number of
votes. So although the notion is that this is super democracy, the practice is in fact the opposite.
That the exact
very
opposite.
Few people will run and very few people will participate and vote. It makes me think of, I talked to someone who had been participating in the water wars in Bolivia in the 2000s, where they seized control of their water, which was being privatized. And then there was an effort to try and democratize the running of this public utility. And at first, there was tremendous participation because people had come out into the streets. And then at a certain point, people didn't want to be involved in the daily running of their water supply. And it seems like the same has been true with this radio network. Ian, did you want to add something?
I'm just imagining the listeners wondering, you know, what on earth is happening? How bad is it? I think what I want to say is that in this conversation, I think we can agree about two major things. We have to stop the bleeding, perhaps. We don't know, actually, what the net liabilities are, even the net assets. The auditing has been very poor. Certainly, listeners should know, some of them do know, that we're facing bankruptcy of some kind or another, possibly Chapter 11, possibly Chapter 7. That would mean liquidation. So, but I think we need to say that it's not yet completely hopeless. So the question will come, well, what could we do to stop the bleeding? Okay. The demonization of WBAI from the West Coast is very understandable, but the fact is, and this is the other point I want to sort of reinforce what Sherry's saying and have these two things on the table, like, well, how do we stop the bleeding? It would be not a good thing, bankruptcy. People, I think, of whatever persuasion might agree that we don't just want lawyers feasting on the carcass of Pacifica, right? Is there a way to stop bankruptcy? But above all, and this is the elephant in the room, and it's, you know, Sherry eloquently has described this, we have to dismantle the governance structure. I am completely convinced of this from my position as a sort of a looking in as a historian or with some time depth. The governance structure put in place in the first years of this century was supposedly an attempt to salvage, under the sign of, you know, save KPFA, take back KPFA, to salvage the the vision of the network. That cannot happen under the current situation, as Sherry says. There's a kind of madness here, and I have to say with some sadness that when I think of Eleanor and Dick Moore and Lou, I mean, the idea that, you know, the cephologists and the alternative voting fundamentalists would have cooked up a thing where we have $20,000 in postage stamps, you know, for an election that is based on a kind of a membership organization that has reached a point where, you know, that's why we're in crisis. It isn't just because of, WBAI is, frankly, a lot of the time, people may not know it on the West Coast, in the last 3 weeks, off the air. There's dead air, not because of the radical, dialogical, formal brilliance of Lou Hill, but it's off the air. There are no listeners because it's not on the air. That's how bad it is. So I think at some point, I hope we have time to discuss, you know, what we might at this 11th hour do about it.
That's the voice of Ian Bull. He's the author of a number of books, including Afflicted Powers and Resisting the Virtual Life. He has been a historian of Pacifica. I'm also joined by Sherry Gendelman. She brought one of the lawsuits against Pacifica in the 1999 crisis, and she's a lawyer and activist. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And we're talking about the current crisis that Pacifica is in. And not this past November, but November of the year before, 2016, the Empire State Realty Trust brought a lawsuit for $1.8 million against KPFA's sister station WBAI for back rent on the antenna that is on top of the Empire State Building, as Sherry mentioned. Although this lawsuit was brought in November of 2016, the Pacifica National Board is in total paralysis about how to address it. And starting this week, this is the week of January 8th, KPFA and KPFK, our sister station in Los Angeles, may have their accounts emptied and liens put against their buildings, which, if it happens, the stations will be forced to go off the air. So in talking about how do we get to this place, and I should say that the National Board has been deadlocked over the question of whether to file for voluntary bankruptcy, where the network would have some say in how bankruptcy unfolds, or to take out a series of subprime loans. But those loans have not been secured, and to the best of my understanding, on Friday, a lawyer for the National Board approached the Empire State Realty Trust with a plan to pay them off based on the series of loans, and the Empire State Realty Trust said, no, we're not interested.
They didn't have a plan to pay off the Empire State Real Estate Trust.
So we're now in a situation that is KPFA, KPFK, because there had to be a 30-day waiting period, where because the network has not filed for bankruptcy, which would be protective.
Correct.
Our assets right now are completely vulnerable to being seized.
Totally. Our assets are vulnerable. The loan that they approached them about was about, my understanding is, a couple hundred thousand dollars, and with assurances that they would get more money to pay off the most recent judgment. People have to be aware, though, that the judgment against WBAI did not terminate the contract, which runs till 2020. So as we speak, WBAI is accruing more monthly debt to the Empire State Real Estate Trust. And the loan the loans that have been floated and proposed to the National Board, some of them come with a conflict of interest. It appears from the information that I have that some of the lenders have relationships to people currently on the National Board. Doesn't seem to be a problem to those people that that's a classic conflict of interest. Also, the loans have no ability or plan that was presented to the Empire State Real Estate Trust, and more importantly, to the current governing board, about how Pacifica and its five stations is going to generate money to repay the loans. So not only are we in debt, the most urgent debt being to this real estate trust, the Empire State Real Estate Trust, who has, you know, now the ability to put a lien on our property, but we are in debt to other people as well. We owe money to our employees' retirement accounts. We owe Democracy Now! Money, and Amy, to her credit, has not demanded that we pay her. And I also want to say that before this acrimony began, Pacifica was able to create and become a incubator for shows such as Democracy Now! And I believe that Brian and Kat and Mitch and Against the Grain, etc., are the same types of shows also. But Amy left the network because of the battles of the late 90s and early 20th century. She is a successful model, and I understand. But the voluntary bankruptcy, while not ideal, as Ian said, may give us the opportunity at least to salvage certainly KPFA and get out from under the bylaws, which I believe is one of the reasons that the board or some half of the board constantly vote against bankruptcy, because they do not want to be disenfranchised, which they may very well be, even if it is a voluntary bankruptcy. It's not ideal. But
so to be clear, if Pacifica went into bankruptcy, into voluntary bankruptcy, then the governance system might be restructured.
Might be restructured. Might be set aside, certainly.
Ian?
Yeah, good people can disagree about which kind of bankruptcy, whether it's a good thing. I just want to say that on the basis of phone calls this morning to New York, that still on the table is a proposal in response to a request for proposals back in November of 2013 by the Pacifica Foundation Radio to enter into a public service operating agreement for programming and supporting the operations of the station, a local management agreement. The LMAs, local management agreements, are pretty common in the nonprofit world, and particularly in media. One of the respondents was the Manhattan Neighborhood Network, whose board has approved, and it's still on the table, and they are in communication with the Empire State Realty Trust still, and I've heard that that's, you know, that those lines are still open. So it is a possibility that the MNN, who are a 25-year-old community media institution with two state-of-the-art media facilities, one in El Barrio at the corner of 104th and Lex, if people didn't know New York, in East Harlem, and one on the west side of Manhattan, that they have a proposal still on the table to, in fact, pay the $2 million, the balance of the lease, to reorganize to Pacifica in such a way that could make it sustainable in the kind of slightly crackpot way that, you know, Lou Hill imagined it in 1949. This is actually a real proposal. There are plenty of course, of those within the Pacifica family, if one can use that word, who fundamentally reject this, and of course the conspiracy theories abound, etc. But the listeners ought to know that this is still a proposal, a live proposal, which would at least could allow us to start the conversation. But in my view, as I say, to repeat, it isn't no longer just a question of lumber on for another couple of years. We have to change the government structure.
We have to change the government structure. And I just want to say that there is another proposal, or there is another idea floated around, and that was a signal swap of WBAI, which is in the commercial band of the FM dial, and with a station down the dial that is in the non-commercial band of FM radio. The problem is, and there is a broker or an agent who has been exploring signal swaps for WBAI and maybe W in Washington, D.C. However, that is not in the commercial band and would not bring in as much money. The benefit of a signal swap would be that The WBAI signal is quite valuable. So you might be able to swap down the dial for a smaller signal for WBAI, but then generate in an ideal world $20 million that would not only pay off the current debt of Pacifica, which is around $8 million, in addition to creditors in addition to the Empire State Real Estate Trust, but it would give us money to you know, explore ideas about promoting the real talent that resides within the network. The problem is that everyone in the media community knows that KPFA and Pacifica are in chaos, and therefore we're not getting the value of the offers that the stations or the signal swaps are actually worth in a market where they didn't think we were having a fire sale of our signals.
So, Sherry Gendelman, one of the questions that I've received is, so why can't KPFA just break away? If KPFA is tethered to a network which is mismanaged and has a governance structure that is going to, in some ways, ensure that it continues to be mismanaged to the point that even the California Attorney General has stepped in, there's questions about our nonprofit status and so on. If it's this dire, why can't KPFA just go it alone?
Many people have explored that question over the course of the last decade. KPFA is not a legal entity. The legal entity is Pacifica. Pacifica owns KPFA's license. And I do want to let the listeners know that there is a group now within the KPFA community that I am part of that is made up of people who were my opponents to some degree, even though they were other members of the other lawsuits, who are working desperately for a legal and financial and political solution to the current crisis that we are facing. But perhaps emerging out of bankruptcy or a reorganization, KPFA, with the assistance of some other nonprofits, might be able to become its own independent legal entity. But it is not a legal entity at this point. And until Pacifica determines to trade or swap that license to a nonprofit created by our listeners with the approval of the FCC, then KPFA is not a legal entity.
What do you think needs to be done, Ian, taking that somewhat longer view? I mean, obviously, yeah. There are questions right now, which, you know, in a couple of days, it may all change to do with bankruptcy and loans and other possibilities. But in terms of this bigger picture, this bigger crisis that is not going to be solved, even if the short-term one is, what about that?
Yeah. The long view tells us that in the politics of media, Pacifica and KPFA have, and the KPFA community have changed slogans and indeed how we think of ourselves here at this station and in the network. I mentioned Eleanor McKinney. The founders were very clear. They knew that in order to survive, they had to put on the cloak of, we could call it First Amendment radio. That's the first sort of decade, First Amendment, because in other words, they had to hire constitutional lawyers to get them through the witch hunts. As the 60s rolled on, this station became, if you like, a movement radio, and then that was sort of shifting into what we might call a community radio, and Save and Take Back movements in their various iterations still see themselves as above all local and community. There's a certain lip service to the networking, but I think, and I want to a shout out here for Matthew Lazar, who has done so much good work as the historian of Pacifica. He said something I think important in his piece. I was looking over recently at in the Nation a couple of years ago, saying, well, actually the network that's working at all and is working really well is the affiliate station radio. So even as we hit the rocks this year, and it may be that what we have to do is there's a shipwreck happening. It's a long train wreck, shipwreck, and to salvage it we have to change the governance structure, and above all it seems to me that we have to. It gives us it is a crisis, but it's also the opportunity. What do I think the opportunity is? Well, above all, it seems to me, apart from the reshaping of governance, it is to bring ourselves into the 21st century so that we can, and I don't know what the other proposals that came in when the foundation asked for made those requests back in 13. But certainly the one I know about, which is the Manhattan Neighborhood Network, were clear that what was possible, what is still possible, is to combine these the strengths and talents that integrate, finally, for our decade and the coming years, you know, radio, cable, social media. And that seems to, the conditions of possibility for that reorganization, I'm not sure, but I think out there the listeners need to know that if we don't get this urgent conversation happening now, then probably we will be off the air forever.
Well, let me end by asking you this. In the last 2 years, it seems quite clear from fundraising and from listener feedback that there has been an upswell of listenership to KPFA, and I'm going to guess to other Pacifica radio stations as well, partly related to the ascendancy of Donald Trump, and a sense that there is a need for the kind of programming that this network brings. Yet one often hears that terrestrial radio is waning, that new media is replacing it. So I wanted to ask you both, starting with you, Sherry Gundelman, how important are KPFA and Pacifica to the fortunes of the larger left? With something equivalent to it, could you imagine it easily stepping into the breach if this station, this network, were to go away?
I cannot, and I think Ian referenced earlier the 1996 Telecommunications Act during the reign of Bill Clinton, who I don't think looks good in retrospect, even with this current orange jackass in the White House. I don't know what, you know, possibly could replace this network, particularly now that our struggles are to regain ground that we've lost with net neutrality and other assaults upon the written and broadcast media.
Ian, as a historian of technics and of radio, how do you see the potential demise of KPFA and Pacifica?
That's a good question. Perhaps I'd just finish by saying that in the mid-90s, City Lights published a book edited by Jim Brooke and myself called Resisting the Virtual Life, which was perhaps the first shot across the bows of the, you know, we were living through the there was a tsunami of cyber hype about the digital world, and we uttered a warning based partly on a hunch, partly I think on understanding that there is something specific about audio, about the radio as a medium, that the screen world has its limits. Crude theories of disruptive technology say that, you know, the radio was dead. You know, it's been declared dead many times. It isn't going away. And just talking to my son just earlier today, I asked him and I said, well, Sam, do you listen to any radio? And he said, yeah, of course I do. I stream it all the time, but I don't know. It's podcasts. I don't know. He said, I don't know where it's actually coming from, but I know that I listen to, you know, the program, the excellent programming that, as Sherry says, is still coming out, and even in the last 2 years, especially coming out. So it's enormously important, it seems to me, for reasons having to do with the specificity of the medium, the intimacy, drive time hasn't gone away. The voice, the power of the voice, the power of silence, understood by the founders. And the deeper we get into the screen world, when this guy, Michael Wolff, who's no Tacitus or Gibbon, which is what we need to understand the goings-on in the palace now, I've only read the introduction,
This is the book about
Donald Trump, Fire and Fury, or whatever it is, but where it's quite striking, where we understand that Trump launches a presidential bid in order that he can later have a career in television. This is a weird upside-down world, and we certainly, and above all, it seems to me, we need some slow looking. We need some silence in the Lou Hill fashion, and we need the power of the voice and the conscience at the microphone, both in individual and in community forms, in order to discuss our plight through peaceful dialogics, to get us out of this into the sunlit upland, so we can clearly look at the apocalypse that's coming down from elsewhere.
Well, on that happy note, I want to thank you both for joining me. I've been speaking with Ian Bull, historian of technics, co-author of Afflicted Powers and Resisting the Virtual Life, Sherry Gendelman, longtime activist and lawyer who brought one of the lawsuits against Pacifica in the 1999 crisis and active today in the present one. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.